Morning, everyone. I'm going to call the to order the Civil Law Data Practices Committee. I don't believe we have a quorum yet, but we're going to go ahead and get started because we do have an aggressive schedule. We will approve the minutes once we reach quorum. Representative Lane, your bill is first. Welcome to the committee, and go ahead. I will move House File 1003 and recommend that it be re-referred to State Government Finance.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to do two amendments. There's four in your packet, but I would like to do two of them.
Go ahead. Which one would you like to do first?
A15-0342A.
All right. Representative Lesch will move the A15.
Oh. And there's actually several called A15.
Oh, you know what? We don't have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. All right. We'll go ahead and discuss those. We can't actually move things, I guess, until we get one more person in the room from our committee. So go ahead and explain your amendments and explain the bill, and then hopefully one more person will show up.
Okay. The first amendment that I'd like to do, the A amendment, clarifies the definition and satisfies some concerns from Gerald Carlson about interfering with 2011's bill. And the B amendment adds a piece at the end to make the policy that the city needs to do in order to do this particular bill adds to their what they have to have in their policy. So with that, my fire chief in Columbia Heights requested this change in the law to allow fire and police to donate equipment that is no longer serviceable to them and has minimal or no resale value.
Thank you for recognizing that we have enough people in the room now to make a quorum. First of all, we're going to approve the minutes of March 24th. Representative Grunhagen will move the minutes of March 24th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. The minutes are approved. Representative Lane, we will go ahead and have Representative Lesch move your file 1003, and that would be recommended to go to the Committee on State Government Finance, and then to your amendments.
Okay, we need the A amendment moved.
Right. Representative Lesch will move the A amendment.
And then the B.
Well, let's take the A amendment first.
Okay.
Members, any discussion on the A amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The A is adopted. The next amendment?
The B, same number B.
Representative Lesch will move the B amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
Okay, thank you.
You should have the bill in the order you would like.
Okay, in general, there's no state statute that says a municipality can donate to a nonprofit. Some think that this lack of direct permission doesn't apply to items that have no resale value, but most cities just don't go there. So yet there are items that still are still usable but outdated and don't meet current standards that they just hate to junk. So this could be as simple as giving old cell phones to a domestic abuse shelter, but it could also be equipment that a third world country could use to establish a fire service. For instance, an old fire hose no longer up to standards here could have the brass ends cut off and those sold for scrap, or that still serviceable hose could go to a country in West Africa. And then I have my fire chief here, but let me first say that regarding what is relevant to this committee, the liability immunity, I've reached agreement with Joel Carlson. Adding the A amendment requires the city's policy to disclose that the equipment may be defective, which seems to sufficiently balance out the liability immunity. And I remind you that contrary to the bill in 2011 that let municipalities donate to other municipalities, this bill does not deal with equipment that is still up to code and standards. This bill deals with equipment that has minimal or no resale value, so it would not be of interest to another municipality. So I would like to introduce my fire chief from Columbia Heights, Gary Gorman.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gary Gorman. I'm the fire chief for the city of Columbia Heights. And the fire service, as all of you know, is a very unique business. And our equipment that we have is also very unique in that most of it is designed and built and maintained to national standards. A lot of times, these standards have time frames that this equipment is only good for. And yet, when those pass and we replace this equipment, in reality, that old equipment is still good, it's still usable, and could be used somewhere for the purpose that it was designed for. The problem is that, you know, at least in the United States, if everybody follows the standards, it's really tough to give it to another fire department. Though we do that with some equipment. Through the years, I have sold and have donated used equipment that's safe and is good condition to other fire departments, mostly rural outstate fire departments, where it can still get some use out of it. Otherwise, we have, through the years, have put a lot of this equipment in city auctions and things like that that we're supposed to do, only to find it either that doesn't get sold, or if it does get sold, it's usually by somebody who's just taking it for scrap value, especially some of a lot of the equipment's made with brass and some other metals. So it's really, in somewhat, I think it's really kind of a sad that this equipment that is still usable and could help in as being used for fire service type use is being scrapped or thrown away, or if it doesn't get sold, we end up throwing it in a dumpster. And I just think that's just kind of sad. And another way to pay forward this equipment is to give it to organizations, and there's a few out there that will take this equipment and take it to other countries. I know Mexico is one of them. Central America has a few other countries down there that use this, and West Africa is another area where a lot of this equipment can go to, where it can be used. They don't have these national standards in place that are being overseen by OSHA and NIOSH and some of these other ones, and used to help build the fire services over there. I know that kind of discussion that came up on the Senate side was this liability part, and what I'd like to kind of say on that part is I can have an old fire truck that I want to get rid of, and I go through a bidding process, I advertise and say, you know, give me a bid by this day, kind of an auction type setting. That I have no control of that person that comes in and gives me the highest bid. That can be anybody. It can be Joe Smith off the street, and I hand him the keys, off he goes with a fire truck that's got red lights on it, sirens on it, equipment on it. I have no idea what he's going to use that truck for, how he's going to use it, or what kind of trouble he's going to get in with that vehicle. Yet, having the chance of donating it through a nonprofit, I can research those nonprofits. I can see what their mission is, where this equipment's going to go, where have they sent their equipment before, how is it being used on the other end, and I actually think it's you're better off that way than to just sell it on an auction and anybody can take some of this equipment, which in the wrong hands you can get hurt with. So, and I just think this is actually a better way of dealing with this equipment.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So can you explain a little bit about how the process is going to be to come up with the policy for determining who you're going to give it to? Because, for example, if you have two equally qualified nonprofits that both want to send it out of the country for fire services, how are you going to make sure people aren't picking based on religious preference, or whether it's a religious institution or not a religious institution, or I agree with your religious values and not your... So as we start to get into nonprofits, right, we start to worry about treading on the separation of church and state and people evaluating other people's values. So how are we going to make sure that doesn't happen?
That is a concern. And that's why all these policies, you have to work with our city attorneys and our city councils to make sure that everybody's on the same page with whatever policy we come up with. I know that one of my colleagues, the fire chief in Brooklyn Park, he actually has his own nonprofit that he does this and takes equipment over to Liberia. And he has groups of firefighters that go with the equipment to teach how to use it, trying to set up the fire service over there. I think I can't have a definite answer for that question for you, except that that's something that has to be worked out with the city attorney, the city council, to try to come up with what we believe would be a fair policy that we're not just picking one particular group that's we're always going to give our equipment to if there's other groups that want it. I don't, you know, whether it's we divide it up, whether we each year if we have equipment we give it to a different group in some way like that. But those are all, that's something that actually has to be a concern and part of that policy.
Representative Hellstrom, follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And so all of these policies will have to be adopted by the city council or governing board, or just internally by the department, or
well,
Chief Gorman.
In my city, that's what I would want it to to have the full approval through the city council so they know and understand exactly what that policy is and they approve it. I guess each city would be a little different in how they would put their policy together and who would be the final say in those policies. But I know in my case, I would, every time before I donate equipment, that particular donation would go to my city council for approval to donate to whoever that group is to the city policy. I don't know if every city would do the same thing. I would sure hope they would.
Well, Representative Hailstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the last question. So does the city council then determine what is the surplus property in your community? For example, this is no longer valid, therefore it's legitimate to be given away, or who's going to determine which property is legitimately able to be given away?
Chief Gorman.
Generally, in my community, that would come through me. You know, I have replacement schedules, and you know that I replace equipment, and so somewhere at some point, I have this equipment that I deem is no longer usable, and I try to either sell it or send it to the city auctions or that part of it. So that actually would come through me. But a final list of what we want to give away as a donation would have to end up going through the council for final approval before it could get donated.
Thank you. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lane and Chief Gorman, I think this is a good idea and a good bill, and good luck with it. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chief. These standards, OSHA or NIOSH or the other ones you described, what are the standards that you have to comply with, and what are the reasons that you're giving for why this equipment has passed its useful life?
Chief Gorman.
The biggest standard we use is NFPA, which is National Fire Protection Association. They're the ones that write most of the standards of how our equipment is built and designed. OSHA, NIOSH, their part of it is every time a firefighter gets hurt or gets killed or something bad happens, you know, all the equipment is looked at, and could the equipment be made better to make it safer so that won't happen again? And they're the ones that all these standards generally come through. A perfect example is our protective clothing, our bunker clothes. The standards say replace it every 10 years. Well, I know that I have, you know, paid-on-call firefighters that, except for maybe a couple training fires in that 10 years, may have never even been in a fire in 10 years. Their turnout clothes are probably in a really good shape. I mean, it passes all, you know, the tests that we can do, that, you know, no rips, no tears, the thermal barrier is fine. It's sad that we have to just cut that up and throw it away. Just because the standard says that doesn't meet the standard anymore, and we have them on a schedule to rotate out every 10 years. Yet you can take that somewhere else that doesn't under that NFPA standards, that doesn't have the OSHA NIOSH watching over, and that gear can be very useful, because my colleague, when he goes to Liberia, when he first got there, they were fighting fires with no turnout gear at all, street clothes. So this turnout gear, which may not meet the standard here in this country, is 100 times better than being in your street clothes trying to fight a fire. And again, some of this has to come down on the fire chiefs and the fire service here. I for one, if I think anything would not be safe for anybody, it would be dangerous, I surely wouldn't want to donate it to have somebody else use it, even if it's in a different country, if it truly isn't safe. And I think most fire chiefs out there would feel the same way I do.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Chief, and I appreciate that you know, you've got your national standards, and you feel like you're in a pretty good position to make your own decision on whether this stuff is safe. But I have to say that I find it ironic that the number of times that we come up here where changes are requested in the fire code by chiefs, that state this should be the standard up here, whether it's individual homeowners, individual business owners saying we're in a good position to decide whether or not our property is safe, but the chiefs are coming up here saying nope, you're not. We're in the position to decide what is safe for you, and it's a higher standard, and you just can't do it, and you're lucky you caught these problems now before it caused you some serious trouble, like what the mechanic tells me. And now you're coming up here asking for an exception. because you say you're in a better position to decide whether or not this equipment is safe rather than the national standard. So I hope you take that into consideration when you've got individual homeowners or individual business owners. I own residential real estate, and when I go through the fire code list of things that are patently ridiculous, that make no sense whatsoever, but you guys have decided that we have to do it for our own good. Well, the national standards have decided that you have to do it for your own good, but you want an exception to the rule. So, you know, we're going to pass this today, and I understand it's a shame to see this equipment go to waste, but remember that there are other people in this state that think they're in the same position as you the next time you come up here asking for some different standard on the fire code.
Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Representative, or Mr. Carlson, please come forward. And members, just to let you know, we do have a room reserved for tonight if we need to come back. So we'll try to get through these bills and just address the areas that pertain to this committee. Representative, or Mr. Carlson, please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Joel Carlson, I'm here for the Minnesota Association for Justice, and I appreciate the amendments that Representative Lane has made to the bill. One of the most troubling areas of law I think that we have is our whole issue of tort liability for municipalities. I've had many engaging discussions with Representative Grunhagen about this because we have such a different body of law of liability as it relates for the injuries that municipalities cause to citizens. And now we are adding, you know, the general law in 466 is that municipalities should be responsible for their torts and injuries that they cause, and subject to exception. And we are now adding the 25th exception to municipal liability, the general rule that they should be accountable for their actions. I appreciate the disclosure language that has been added so that you let the people know that this equipment may not be safe for safety purposes, and I think that's appropriate. I appreciate the amendment that didn't touch the language that was adopted in 2011 that mandates that local units of government donate surplus equipment that has value to another local unit of government. That still remains intact with the amendments that have been made. But Madam Chair and members, I appreciate the amendments, but maybe something for the Law School for Legislators. You really need to know that the state of municipal liability in Minnesota is in a very, very difficult case where you can have you can be killed by a police vehicle who doesn't put on their siren against policy, and there's no liability to the municipality. They can do any number of things that any other ordinary citizen would be held accountable for and should be accountable for that we don't impose upon municipalities, and this is now another one. And I just, you know, urge caution as you make these decisions. Although we don't oppose the language as amended, there is a general problem here with municipal liability that I hope you'll consider as other bills come forward. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Representative Lane, we will give you the final word.
Okay, I just think it's a good bill. Pass it.
Okay. All right, very good. Representative Lesh renews his motion that House File 1003 as amended be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way to State Government Finance. Thank you, Representative Lane.
Thank you.
Representative Christensen, you're up next. I just saw him. There he is. And I see that, members, Representative Christensen is coming down here empty-handed, a freshman that is appearing the first time before this committee.
Madam Chair.
Come back tonight.
Madam Chair, we have treats this morning.
Oh, you do have treats?
All right.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Christensen. Representative Grunhagen will move House File 1725. That's the way to do it. All right, go ahead.
Madam Chair, this bill allows folks to file unnecessary notices, documents, and information with the Office of Administrative Hearing, essentially as email file attachments. And I have a representative from OIH with me this morning to explain a little more about why that's necessary.
Great. Go ahead, introduce yourself at the tape, and go ahead with your testimony, please.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Tammy Poost. I'm the Chief Judge at the Office of Administrative Hearings.
And I'm here to ask for your support in favor of House File 1725, which merely helps us bring the Administrative Procedures Act into the 21st century by allowing us to accept electronic filings. The bill's fiscally neutral. We're not trying to design a new computer system. It's just that right now the current law says that we accept filings either by mail, by personal delivery, or by fax, and we would like to allow the members of the public and the state agencies that appear before us to file electronically as well.
Any member questions? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So how are you going to document that someone actually filed on time or that email didn't get lost or go on a spam folder? How are you going to actually make sure that the email meets the standards that we all expect when filing something with a
Judge
court system?
Madam Chair and members, we have protocols in place with through Minute to make sure that we have a record of everything that's actually received. And just like the constitutional court system does, there's a responsibility on the side of filers to keep proof of filing, which is their sent. And so their sent message proof, and we accept those. Now, we also will allow people to file courtesy copies in paper if they want to, but we're finding in the work that we've done previous to bringing this bill, the work with our constituents, that most people trust their systems and that it's really a one-off when something doesn't arrive, and we handle that in a due process manner at that time.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when someone files electronically via email, then will somebody replying we received it, or so they'll know that it isn't just going into some spam folder?
Judge Puss.
Madam Chair and members, yes, there'll be an automatic reply that the system sends out, and we will be doing training on that with our customers so that they know that if they don't get that, that tells them something.
Thank you. Anyone in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing none,
who did I have?
Representative Gruen renews his motion that House File 725 be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion is approved.
Thank
You're
you,
on your
Chair.
Way. Thank you, Representative Christensen and testifiers. The next bill on the agenda is Representative Smith, House File 1470.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I move House File 1470 before the committee. And Madam Chair, members, House File 1470 is the annual administrative bill by the Secretary of State's office. And I have Mr. Burt Black with us today to talk about this, to briefly talk about this non-controversial bill.
Thank you for being here, Mr. Black. Go ahead and introduce yourself with the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Burt Black. I'm the legal advisor to the Office of the Secretary of State. In your packet, I believe you have a handout on this bill. You have a busy schedule today, so I'll be as brief as I can. This bill is our annual administrative bill. We gather information from our stakeholders and internally in the office to try and improve processes. This year we have basically, it's seven sections, but really four goals. The first is we're going to make the IRS federal tax lien filings. We're going to charge a flat fee for that. There has been a tiered fee, but the extra tier only brings in $315 in revenue. And so it's really rather inefficient to try and distinguish between those two things. We're also going to a flat fee for the reinstatement of foreign corporations. Foreign corporations meaning anybody who's not a Minnesota corporation. They come in and they register with us. They have to keep current with their annual filing. If they don't, they're revoked. And when they want to reinstate, there's a tiered filing. And so that's, again, a very inefficient. And, in fact, we can't do a computer online filing on that for that reason, so we want to make that a flat fee. Sections 3, 4, 5, and 6 relate to public benefit corporations. And the bill that was passed last year, we're doing two things here. We're making a clarification in the due date for the annual report to make sure that it's before April 1st as opposed to 90 days. And then also we're making sure that if a public benefit corporation, if their status is revoked, that they have to change their name so they're not fooling the public by claiming to be a public benefit corporation when they're not. And then finally, a clarification on the farm lien language in Chapter 336A that was passed many years ago, 22 years ago, before the internet, and we want to acknowledge that these inquiries are now going to be made online and not orally, so we have a change in the language there. I'll be glad to stand for any questions, but that is essentially the bill.
Thank you. Any committee member questions? Seeing none, anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Not seeing anyone. Representative Smith renews his motion that House Bill 147 be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Is Representative Hancock in the room? Don't see Representative Hancock. We will move ahead to, is Representative Franzen in the room?
Madam Chair, I'll do Representative Franzen's bill if you.
All right, sounds great. Thank you, Representative Hoppe. And we are only going to be looking at certain sections of the Franzen bill. The sections that pertain to the background check and the civil liabilities. So. Representative Hoppe will move House File 683. Go ahead, Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am obviously not the author, not an expert on this, but I like the idea of what we're doing. And I think that the issue before us is, as you said, is the background checks and just making sure that people that are going to go into and start growing in an experimental basis hemp aren't have some kind of a criminal background, and we're I think we want to make sure that we're not confusing industrial hemp with any sort of non-industrial hemp or anything that could be turned into marijuana, medicinal or otherwise. And industrial hemp cannot be. It's for rope and clothing and things like that. And I think the issue here is just to make sure that that is in fact what's being grown and that people have passed the background checks, so we're not, I don't know, planting other things between the rows or something like that. And I'm not sure if Representative Franzen had a testifier here. Is there anybody behind me that looks like they're coming up and helping me? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Is there anyone here? Okay, here comes the gentleman to testify on behalf of the file in front of us. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union. We've worked on this bill for a long time, and we support Senate, House File 683. I feel it has great potential. I'm not going to go into all the great things about hemp. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them. We do feel that there is significant protections in this, as you just heard, some of the things that your committee is looking at, the background checks, and we also think that, keep in mind, this is a pilot scale bill at first, and then it also provides rulemaking if we're going to move forward. And also really briefly looking at the change in this bill has been around for a long time. The change in this bill is the 2014 Farm Bill authorized these pilot projects. We've had the hemp bill, it's passed legislature many times, but the Farm Bill that passed last year authorize this, and so you're seeing a lot of states pass this bill. Just in the last week, North Dakota, New Mexico legislatures passed this bill. Missouri, Alaska, others have joined. Colorado, Kentucky, and other states. Kentucky's probably a year ahead of us, a year ahead of Minnesota in this bill. And I also looked at some of the background and the requirement checks there, and what kind of problems they've had, and that led me to Manitoba, which is just north of us, as many of you know. So our farmers in northwestern Minnesota grow this. Our farmers in northwestern Minnesota are very familiar with what's grown just over the border in Manitoba. And I looked at some of the quotes from the Manitoba police, who have had this for 10 years and have never had a problem with this, by the way. They've never had an incident in all the years of finding marijuana growing within industrial hemp. It doesn't grow well together. But they've also just never had a problem. But I think the background checks do make people feel comfortable, and urge your consideration of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Are there member questions? Seeing none, Representative Hoppe renews his motion that House File 683. Oh, I'm sorry. I did forget to ask for testifiers from the audience. Thank you for the reminder. Go ahead and state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair, my name is David Kolb, and I'm here representing the Minnesota State Police Chiefs Association. Mm-hmm. And I won't take up much of your time, just a few concerns we believe the committee should be aware of. The bill, of course, differentiates between hemp and recreational marijuana, hemp having a lower level of THC, which is the hallucinogenic material in marijuana, below 0.3%. And just to be clear, we believe that any substance with that low of a level of THC is not problematic. That does not cause the type of problems we're concerned about in law enforcement. However, our concern is that we do not currently have the ability to differentiate in the field the difference between that lower level of THC in plant material and a higher level. And so based on that, we believe there are some issues here that we're going to have concerns with, because an officer in the field simply won't be able to differentiate between the two. In the bill, it talks about the transport of the material, but it really doesn't differentiate between the transport of the stalks and the fibrous material, which I think is beneficial and what the agricultural use is for, versus the leaves and the buds and so on. So that may not be the specifics you're addressing today, and I won't take up much of your time, but just for the committee to be aware of, we are working with the Department of Public Safety to try to find some solutions to these problems, but we do, at this point, still believe that's problematic.
Thank you. Representative Franzen is here, and she's switching seats with Representative Poppy. Is there anyone else in the audience?
Oh, can I just ask a question?
Yes, Representative Hillstrom, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Where is this bill going?
This bill is going to public safety.
Okay.
Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Welcome to the committee. Thank you for your testimony, sir. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the tape, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members, Jim Franklin, Executive Director for the Sheriff's Association. We want to work with the farms on this particular product. We think that it may have some value down the road. Our concerns, and I won't duplicate what the chiefs have already highlighted in the bill specific to this committee, is the background checks. Nothing in the bill talks about defining the applicant as to whether that's a corporate structure or individual. Transportation and who's transporting, it does not appear to be background checks. Employees do not appear to be background check. And the rules as they will be established, we are hoping that we law enforcement will have an opportunity to participate in that rules with the agricultural people as you move forward. To this point, we've not been engaged in that. We think that's an important element that we could add something to that to help develop this technology, this product that might be a useful product into the future. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks, but those are technicalities that we think should be addressed at some point in time.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Franzen, do you have an issue with expanding the background check or making it more clear that it's anybody who grows it or transports it? That's what they're asking for.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hillstrom. I don't believe that we do have an issue with that. This is the most that I've gotten out of law enforcement since I've introduced the bill.
Thank you, Representative Franzen. And any other members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none and no further questions, Representative Hoppe. Oh, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that the background checks is within this jurisdiction, and it is going to public safety, but given the author doesn't have an issue, it would be my intention to make sure that the language is clear that it's anybody who grows it or transports it should have to have the background check, Madam Chair. And I can work with the author between now and the next committee.
Thank you. Seeing no other discussion on the bill, Representative Hoppe renews his motion that House File 683 be re-recommended to the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Your bill is on its way, Representative Franzen. Next bill up is Representative Hancock. Brian.
to remove that House File 233. Move to the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Committee. Mr. Representative Hancock, go ahead with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 233 basically provides for the use of interactive video conferencing in civil commitment hearings. It's permissive in its language. It is in compliance with the general rule practice of Rule 131 and the Minnesota Rule of Civil Commitment, Rule 14. It is not designed to replace these, but it is designed to recognize the importance that interactive video conferencing can play in the process. And that's the purpose. It basically codifies the fact that interactive video conferencing is a valuable tool that can be used.
Thank you, Representative Hancock. Is there anyone in the public wishing to testify on this bill? Are there any member questions? Representative Johnson.
Representative Hancock, I want to thank you for this bill. I believe this is going to save counties a lot of funds. I've been involved in having to drive 6 hours one way to pick a person up to bring them back for court for 3 minutes of court time and drive that person 6 hours back to the facility they were at. So I think in the long run, this bill is going to save the counties across the state a lot of funding, and I want to thank you for it.
Thank you. Representative Hancock, it looks like you have a testifier.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ben Ashley Wertman. I am the Policy and Outreach Associate at the Mental Health Association of Minnesota. We represent 75 years of education and advocacy for people with mental illnesses. As Representative Hancock has stated, 233 places references into two existing Minnesota court rules into our civil commitment statute. It's clarifying and hopefully, to the bill author's intentions, expanding the use of interactive video. Because it's reinforcing current policy, we don't have a formal position, but we have two pieces of context that we think are important for you as you consider this bill. In some situations, ITV is certainly an improvement. It's situations where an individual could not otherwise attend a proceeding due to their medical condition. It's a valuable backstop to allow for more flexibility. But commitment involves a serious and invasive suspension of a person's rights to choose how they live, what medical care they receive, and where they will be. It's only fair that they get their chance to stand in court whenever possible, and certainly at all times to be involved in their own defense. When we talk with people who have missed opportunities for due process, that point becomes a focal point for them of resistance and anger that clouds their ability to engage in treatment going forward. We think ITV should always be an option, but it should never be a default for addressing challenges of distance. Secondly, ITV does not entirely eliminate that challenge of distance. The county and the sheriffs are certainly alleviated of the responsibility of transporting the patient, but the attorney must then travel for the respondent. Court rules and certainly good practice requires that they be physically present to be able to effectively confer with their client. One member of the Hennepin Civil Defense Panel gave me a recent example. He had an entire day of travel and work for a civil commitment client who would be paid at the same rate as if he had worked only 60 to 90 minutes for a private client. As the author has said, ITV is already an option. It can be a valuable tool. We do ask that the committee take some notice of the challenges that can emerge if this practice becomes more widely adopted for civil commitment hearings. Due process and effective representation is important as a safeguard for individual rights, as well as for ensuring medical outcomes of individuals in a very vulnerable situation. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Any member questions? Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing no one, Representative Johnson renews his motion that House File 233 be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Crime Prevention. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion is adopted. Thank you, Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next up, Representative Mack. And we have House File 1535. I will move House File 1535.
Let's kill this.
And if staff could tell us what areas of this bill relate to this committee, since it is a hundred and I don't know how many pages. It's thick.
Chair and representatives, House File 1535 has civil law provisions in, and this is in the first engrossment, has civil law provisions in Section 4 through 32 of Article 1. These relate to the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act. Section 31 of Article 1 related to child maltreatment reporting screening. Section 33, which clarifies certain types of data related to child fatalities. And Section 34, which revives a, I believe, accidentally deleted portion of the child support statute. In Article 3, Sections 1 and 2, those relate to civil commitment hearings. And in Article 4, Section 12 relates to the burden of proof in certain agency hearings. Sections 20 through 26, I believe, relate to the prescription monitoring program. Sections 32 and 39 relate to background studies, changes and clarifications. And Section 47 relates to administrative subpoenas. And I believe that's everything for the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Mullen. And Representative Mack, are there amendments that we need to take care of first?
Madam Chair and members, I believe that you have an A3 amendment that I would like to get put on the bill.
All right, sounds good. And Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, we were handed out two letters in the middle of the last bill that clearly relate to some health care bill, and it references Senate File 1078. Since I don't see a Senate file on the calendar, can we get a clarification? Do these letters from Essentia Health and Association of Minnesota Counties relate to this bill or another bill?
Representative Lesh, that relates to House File 683, which we already passed.
Oh, it was that.
Yeah, good question, though. Yeah, it did address the Senate file only. I understand the confusion. All right. Representative Mack, does the A3 apply to this committee? You want to have somebody briefly tell us a little bit about what that does?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just for clarification, the two letters must have been passed out by mistake. They related to my Hennepin Health bill that was pulled from the agenda.
Oh, very fine. Thank you. So it wasn't 683. Representative Mack.
Madam Chair and members, the A3 amendment relates to some issues that were hashed out on Friday in the Health Policy Committee, just to try to get the bill in the shape that stakeholders in the department and some members around the table had agreed on to work on. And so I'm hoping to get the A3 on to get along with the Senate and get the bill in the shape I'd like it moving forward. So not much that needs to be addressed in this committee.
The only thing that would need to be addressed is trying to get along with the Senate. So it is a hopeless cause. Seeing no discussion on the amendment, all those in favor of adopting the A3, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A3 is on. There is an A4 before us. Representative Grunhagen, is that your amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the A4 amendment.
All right. Can you tell us what it does, please?
Basically, we had the informational hearing regarding the electronic health care mandate. Just to remind members, 48 states do not have the mandate. The federal law is permissive in regards to this. Two states, Massachusetts and Minnesota, had the federal mandate. Massachusetts has modified theirs for smaller providers. So Minnesota is the only state that doesn't. This amendment addresses that by allowing up to providers with up to seven.
No more than six, I believe it says.
Yeah, it says no more than six, including the provider. So actually it's seven.
Okay.
And that confused me for a day or two, too. But it's government count, evidently. But this would exclude them. I've had numerous emails about the burdensome requirement. I also believe that if we leave the mandate in place, we're going to lose providers and reduce health care access for the citizens of the state of Minnesota at a time we're already experiencing shortages. There's another other pros and cons, but that's the gist of the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Gruenhagen. Is there a member discussion? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been working on this for quite a while as well, as Representative Gruenhagen knows. So there was the hearing in, I think it was early February, and after that I did hear from a couple constituents as well. I've had extensive discussions with MDH about this mandate. So I gather this was passed, I think, in 2008, went into effect the beginning of the year, and there are many good reasons for providers to be using electronic health records, and I know that our state is quite far along compared to other states in terms of the use of these records, presumably because of the mandate. I have, and I should apologize, Madam Chair and members of the committee, that being so new here, I feel like I've made a couple mistakes and that it didn't occur to me. So I've introduced a bill working with MDH to exempt individual providers in private practice from the electronic health record mandate. For those individual providers that feel a burden in terms of costs and also concern for their patients, it does seem to me that we should be exempting them from the mandate. And there's a couple of other carve-outs as well. It had not occurred to me to present that as an amendment to the HHS policy bill. It probably should have. It seems kind of obvious in retrospect that it has to do with Health and Human Services policy, so apologies. And then I actually had not caught Representative Gruenhagen's amendment until this morning. I'm concerned in talking with MDH, with my constituents and others, that going out as many as six providers in a practice, that's at a place where those providers, it does make sense for them to be using electronic records to be communicating among themselves about their patients. There are huge benefits in terms of patient safety and other issues when it comes to using electronic records. And in working with the health department and talking with providers and others, I guess I would speak against this particular version of exemption, and that in my view, having worked on this for quite a while now, this does go too far. A limit exemption would work, and again, I apologize for the procedural posture not being able to present that at this point.
Thank you.
Although, as I say, I do have the language in the form of a bill. My apologies. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your comments, Representative Pinto. Representative Mack, comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and thank you, Representative Gruenhagen. We have been in touch on this issue quite a bit this session and past sessions, understanding the challenge of some of our small providers. And so in regards to this amendment, I'll leave it up to the committee in the sense that as we head to the floor with this bill, we've kind of agreed with the Senate to pre-conferee it and kind of go to the floor trying to make sure that we're all moving in the same direction. So the department is fine with this amendment, as well, long as Representative Gruenhagen is open to some technical changes needed. I know the Department of Health is still looking at this, just making sure that the number's at the right amount and it's workable. So if Representative Gruenhagen's open to possibly just some technical changes for the floor to make sure that this gets in line and works with the Senate, with that agreement, I would be open to putting this on today and taking into consideration Representative Pinto's concerns. I think we can work on it, but we can take this today and then head to the floor willing to work on it.
Representative Gruenhagen, you want to respond to that?
Yes, Madam Chair, and thank you for those comments, Representative Mack. I've talked to the department this morning, and I told them I'm more than willing to sit down and listen to their concerns, and they don't support this amendment right now in its current form. They have concerns, and Representative Pinto and I have been in contact quite a bit over the last several weeks about this, and so I would be willing to take those into consideration along with input from Representative Mack on the final version as far as any modifications that might come up when it comes to the House floor.
Thank you, Representative Gruenhagen. Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think that the conversation about this is important to have. I don't anticipate it's going to come in on the Senate side. The only way we have that conversation is that we pass Representative Gruenhagen's amendment in here and then have the conversation either ahead of time or on the House floor. So I think it's pretty important in light of this committee's historical consideration of personal privacy data, including health data. I want us to put this on, so I'm supportive, Representative Gruenhagen. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I just find myself in more and more agreement with Representative Lesch over the last few days.
Strike the record.
Representative Hillstrom, I think, had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Gruenhagen, as long as you're willing to work with folks on this, and hopefully there can be agreement, it would be a shame if you took down an entire bill on this over this subject. But
when we finish with the amendment, Madam Chair, I have a number of questions.
All right. Any other member questions? All those in favor of adopting the A4, please signify. Oh, wait. The A4 first engrossment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Hillstrom, do you have questions on the bill then?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
So, Madam Chair, I'm really curious. I was looking. I thought it said it was in Article 3, based on contact that we had with DHS, that there was some provisions about changing background study changes based on what we did in the last biennium, which probably was my bill. So I want to make sure that they highlight for me what it is that they're specifically changing. It says that there's a shift in the burden of proof. I'd really like to talk about what that is. And then where does this go next, Madam Chair?
Representative Hillstrom, this bill goes to the General Register.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So there's some penalties in here, criminal penalties that are changed. And so especially on page 105, it talks about financial transaction card fraud, which is a crime, and it adds a whole ton of new language. And then there's a violation and penalties in the bill. And then it creates a new line for engaging in the trafficking of SNAP benefits. So my question is, if you're adding additional felonies, did somebody request a fiscal note on the penalties, and why then isn't it going to public safety?
Madam Chair.
Representative Matt.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom. Appreciate the question. And just for clarification, for the sake of the committee, when we walked through this with the Senate and the department a few weeks back, we actually created a mini bill that extracted any parts of this bill that had to go around to different committees, including the sections that you're talking about. So the article that you're talking about is also included in a mini bill, and I can get the House file number here momentarily. House file 1677, and that's up in public safety at 10 o'clock this morning.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then I just want to make sure that you're not going to be bringing this bill up on the floor until all of those little mini bills have been heard in the proper committee, they've been changed, and then you'll be bringing amendments to this on the floor. Is that the way it's going to work?
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom, absolutely to the first part of your question, we've been working strategically with the department and the Senate to do this in the most efficient way possible to make sure all the parts get to the proper committees. But there, everything is also contained in this full bill. But everything is getting its proper stop and working with the Senate and then taking it to the floor with everything having gone through the proper channels that it needed to.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then did they request a fiscal note on the entire bill or on each individual bill? Or how are we going to know if what's in this bill actually costs money?
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom. My understanding, particularly of the mini-clone bill, is if there was a fiscal note, that would be figured out on that mini-clone bill regarding to the provisions that you're referencing. But it's also my understanding that the intention was for this to strictly be a policy bill. If there are things with cost implications, there's a very good chance that those parts will not move forward.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then if you could enlighten me as to where I might find the background study changes that you're making and what changes you're making, because ultimately that was probably my bill that you're undoing.
Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom. And I guess I'll leave this up to the chair. We can bring people forward to cover that particular part, or if we do the bill walkthrough, just through the sections that we're going over, and get to that part, whatever you would prefer.
Representative Hillstrom, are you, the areas that you're interested in, are those more public safety related, or they can pertain to this committee?
Well, Madam Chair, it's my understanding that these are the issues that were highlighted that should be dealt with here.
Okay.
And so that's why I'm asking, because if they're going to public safety and you want me to address them there, we can do that too. But I see that there's a burden of proof shifting. I want to make sure that that's in the civil law section. So I want to make sure that we know what burden shifting is, and then we do all the background study language here, so I want to make sure I understand what they're doing to it.
All right, great.
Madam
Representative
Chair.
Mack, if we could just hit that area first, please.
Yep, Madam Chair, that will be in Article 4, covered mostly is in Section 12, 24, and 41, and Jerry Kerber will be coming forward to discuss those parts of the bill
right.
this morning.
And if
for,
you could have page
guys.
Numbers, that would be helpful.
Okay.
In this committee, yep.
I will see if we can get those. So, Madam Chair, do you want to just start in order of the bill with Article 1, and we'll get to Article 4 that Representative Hillstrom is referring to in those particular concerns.
Go ahead, Representative Mack.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I will just immediately, in this, for the sake of time, turn it over to someone from the department to start walking us through Article 1.
Super. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Nikki Farrago from the Department of Human Services, and I'll be doing the walkthrough of Article 1. Article 1 is the Children and Families article in House File 1535. It makes policy changes to, for this committee, Indian child welfare, some child protection provisions, and a couple of child support provisions. So I'm going to go through as in groups, and I can answer any questions about the detailed sections. So the first group of sections is related to Indian child welfare. These are in sections 4 through 6, 8 through 30, and 32. This group of sections gets to the disparities that our American Indian families in Minnesota face, namely the disparities related to out-of-home placements. American Indian children are 15 and a half times more likely to experience an out-of-home placement than a white child in Minnesota. This is the highest out-of-home placement disparity in the country. There are two pieces of legislation that are can help address these disparities, the Federal Indian Child Welfare Act of 1978, and here in the state of Minnesota, the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act. But we continue to see an inconsistency and lack of compliance across counties. So we've made some changes that will increase that compliance across the board. I want to stress that we've worked over the past 9 months or more cooperatively with county attorneys, with county social service agencies, and the tribes, in addition to DHS representatives, to get to agreed-upon language that you see here today. So this can be organized into four different categories. We've established new definitions and made amendments to other definitions. We established a purpose statement in the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act to underscore the importance. We've clarified requirements that are mandated by the federal act and also mandated compliance with the state act throughout child protection proceedings. Moving on to the child protection sections, Section 7 is related to child maltreatment appeals for American Indian Child Welfare Initiative tribes. This addresses the lack of clarity around where appeals of child maltreatment determinations should be heard for the, when the tribe makes that determination, whether it should be in the state process or whether the tribe should do it themselves. So this language just clarifies that the tribes can make that decision. They can choose whether or not to use the state system or create their own. Section 33 is related to the disclosure of information for child fatalities and near fatalities. This is a federal compliance issue. We need to...
Can I interrupt you 1 second? Representative Hillstrom, do you have a question to this section?
Yes, Madam Chair. Actually, I was just going to ask about the Indian Child Welfare Project. On page 6, line 6.20, it says the commissioner may authorize projects to the alternative methods. So the commissioner will be determining if the process that's set up by the tribe is approved or not approved in order to get them to... come into compliance with, you said they could pick.
Farrico?
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, yes, that's correct. And this this language was reorganized. The commissioner has always had that authority for the project. It's just restated below for the investigating and assessing reports. And then this is adding that, in addition, the commissioner would authorize those administrative and judicial appeals processes.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead and proceed.
So again, thank you, Madam Chair. Section 33, again, is related to federal compliance. The Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act requires certain disclosures around fatalities and near fatalities of children. So this section reorganizes the statute to make it clear what is disclosed, and it also adds a threshold of when that information is disclosed. The final group is child support related. Section 31 is related to unemployment compensation income withholding requests from tribal child support agencies. Currently, DEED does these withholdings from unemployment compensation when a request is received from an agency, usually a county. But four Minnesota tribes now run their own child support agencies. And when they make those withholding requests of DEED, they have not been successful. All the parties agree that this should change and this withholding should occur, but this makes it explicit in the statute to allow for that to happen. And the last section is Section 34. This revives language that was inadvertently repealed last session in 2014 related to income withholding that can be done administratively by the child support agency. And that concludes Article 1.
Thank you. The next area is Article 3. Do you have a different testifier for that, Representative Mack?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Is that Mr. Kerber?
Is actually going to be Sheila Brandt.
Okay.
From the department.
Ms. Brandt, welcome to the committee. Go ahead and what page does Article 3 start on? I'm trying to find that.
Madam Chair, that page is page 60 to 61.
Thank you. Go ahead with introduce yourself, please, and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sheila Brandt, and I'm the Legislative Director for Direct Care and Treatment Administration within DHS. The proposal in Article 3 was actually brought to the department by the tribes here in Minnesota. The current issue is that while all federally recognized tribes in the state have the ability to pursue civil commitment through tribal courts, only the courts that have entered into an agreement with the Commissioner of DHS in those courts, those are the orders that are able to be recognized. These agreements that are created between the tribes and the commissioners assure that things such as evidentiary standards, due process issues, they meet the same threshold of the state as civil commitment occurs in our state courts. So to this point, as you look at the language, there are only two tribes that are currently in this part of statute. Those include the White Earth Nation and Red Lake. Those are the two tribes that have engaged in those agreements with the commissioner. The tribes have requested more expansive language to allow clarity so that all tribes are able to engage in these agreements with respecting the language that's already been developed between White Earth Nation and Red Lake.
Thank you very much. Member questions on Article 3, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so once the tribe commits, do they then come to the state facility? And so that's the reason for the approval or not approval of the commitment process.
The testifier.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that's correct.
Thank you. Okay, we're ready to move on to Article 4. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Mack.
On this section, members, we have Jerry Kerber. And I can,
okay.
And he'll walk us along with page numbers.
Very good, thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Kerber. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the head of the Inspector General's Office of the Department of Human Services. So I'm going to talk about Article 4, and there will be those background study provisions coming up in a moment. The first one that we've been asked to talk about is Section 12, and that's the one that talks about the standard of evidence for our temporary immediate suspension hearings. And really what we're doing here is not so much as changing it as we're kind of clarifying. So if you look at this, and this is on page 65 of the bill, what we're trying to make it clear is that there's two situations in which we issue temporary immediate suspensions. One is sort of right out of the box where we determine that the conditions of a license holder present imminent risk of danger to people receiving services. And so the law directs us in those cases to quickly do a temporary immediate suspension of the license. And so the standard there is imminent danger. The legislature added a second situation, though, however, is if a license holder is operating under the appeal of a revocation. So if we issue a revocation, an order of revocation, the provider can appeal that order, and then they can continue operating pending the outcome of a contested case hearing. It's during that second situation that if you look on Section 11, if you look on the previous page of the bill, page 64, line 19, it already sets a standard there for when we would issue those types of temporary immediate suspensions. And so we're just making it clear then in the corresponding hearing language that that's the same standard we have to meet in the hearing. The next sections then get into the a little bit more of the other sections of the data prac, or excuse me, get into our background study law a bit, and I would jump to page 84 of the bill for that language. On page 84, you'll see that what we're doing here is expanding slightly the definition of what it means to have access to a person's in a program. When we disqualify people under the background study law, we disqualify them from providing direct contact services or having access. And the access has been defined as having access to their personal property, but we're expanding it here to include the person's personal, financial, and health information. And we determined that was really necessary because in some situations what we found is that people were disqualified through our background study system for identity theft or fraudulent crimes, but yet they could technically be moved over into the section of the businesses handling the billing. And so they could still have access to all kinds of personal information of the people, including social security numbers, sensitive health data. So we're just expanding that. Section 34 is section 34, 35, excuse me, 32, 33, and 34, all on page 84 and then into 85, kind of go together. And what these provisions are doing is updating our background study law following some significant changes made last year by the legislature, where we're converting over to a new system where we don't have to repeat background studies on people. Once they've had a background study done by us, that background study will be good. Other providers will still have to come in and initiate it to see if a background study has been done. But because we don't have to repeat background studies on people, because we're getting information from MNSIS on a regular basis, what we're doing here is saying that those agencies that today are responsible for doing a background study every year won't have to do that anymore when they convert over to our new system.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Kerber, so what's going to happen is if they then get a disqualification, it's going to pop up and it's going to notify you that they're now disqualified? Or if they don't have to do a study every year, how are you going to know when someone's been charged with a crime, someone's
mm-hmm. got a... Kerber.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, what we're setting up here is a connection with MNSIS, Minnesota Court Information System. So the whole background study system works such that when an employer does a background study on somebody through us, that individual remain on that employer's roster. And that individual can be on any number of rosters affiliated with any number of employers. As long as somebody's on the roster, on a continuous basis, we're going to be getting new entries made in the MNSIS system, new conviction information. And so what we're designing here is a system that will filter out. We don't want to know all new criminal activity that's being recorded in MNSIS all day long throughout the state, but only the information that pertains to one of those people that's on one of our rosters. And so it'll be always pinging against our list of people that we care about. And then it'll further filter out, you know, if they're convicted of a crime that we don't care about because it's not listed in our statute. But so as long as we have that continuous feeding of information to the department, then we don't need to go back to the BCA and say, you know, on a regular basis and say, was anything added to their record since the last time we checked, because we're going to be updated.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The only challenge with that is MNSIS is only Minnesota in Minnesota. What are you going to do then about other states? Because MNSIS does not reflect what happened in Wisconsin or New York or Chicago or any of those other places.
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom, that's kind of a weakness of our current system also, in that we currently check against the Minnesota records, the BCA, for most of our studies. Some of them we routinely do FBI record checks. But for the lion's share of our background studies, and we did 312,000 last year, most of those are compared against Minnesota records. And the BCA record in Minnesota indicates whether somebody is a single state offender or a multi-state offender, because the BCA has pinged with the FBI. And so if they're a multi-state offender, then we get their fingerprints and we do an FBI record check. Under the new system, we'll automatically do that FBI record check if they're a multi-state offender. But there is not currently any mechanism for feeding back whether or not somebody went to Las Vegas and committed a crime there and then came back. We'll be back to the legislature in a year or two, though, asking for the authority to do FBI record checks on everybody. And the FBI is setting up what they call a wrap-back system, where as long as we have initiated a background study on somebody, from Minnesota, if they create a new record on that person or they add to an existing record, we would be notified. So we're not there yet, but the kind of the design is in place that we're working towards.
Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom. Thank you, Madam Chair. But on these people that had to have background checks every year, mm-hmm. weren't you finding out about other states, which now you're not going to because you're only going to be getting the updates from MNCIS?
Representative Kerber. Excuse me, Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom, probably not that often. I mean, I think in general what we found in our background studies is when somebody's working in Minnesota, it's not that common that they then leave the state and go commit crimes and come back. I mean, I can't say it's never happened, but generally the people who are employed here aren't getting convicted of serious crimes in other states anyway that cause them to have a separation from employment that would cause them to have another background study here find that they're now a multi-state offender. It's not out of the question, but it you know, we haven't seen that.
Representative Hillstrom. Thank you, Madam Chair. So maybe we can talk about that a little more, because especially in border cities, mm-hmm. whether you're on this side of the river or the other side of the river, it's pretty easy to cross back and forth, and I find it hard to believe that it's not more of an issue in some of those places.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, and Representative Hillstrom, I'd be happy to talk with you about that some more.
Mr. Kerber, go ahead with your testimony.
Okay. So that brings us down to Section 35, and this is just an update of our background studies. An update of our computer system allows us to take driver's license numbers from other states. And so we're simply striking the term Minnesota as a descriptor of the background of the driver's license data we collect. Section 36 is on page 86 also. And that's just some language that makes it more clear when a background study that's been initiated by an employer can be kind of shared and meet the requirements for background studies across different services operated by that same organization. Section 37 is on page 88, and this is a provision that we're just clarifying here that when it comes to the decision about who pays for the background study, that's really between the employer and the employee and the prospective employee. And the legislature, I believe it was 2006, removed the distinction from our background study law that said that individuals can't be required to pay for the background study. However, there's this other statute, 181, that was passed earlier that says that employees can't be asked to pay. And so we're just trying to kind of verify here that the legislature's intent in the most recent decision they made was the one that carries the day. So that brings us down to Section 38. Section 38 and 39 go together, and they talk about, again, about background studies that are done by other entities. So we do background studies for training programs. So if somebody's going to school to be an RN, or they're going to school to be a physician, or they're going to school physical therapist, occupational therapist, any of those, or a certified nursing assistant, we do background studies for the schools so that at the time that the individual is going to do a practicum or an internship, the background study is already taken care of. What we're doing here is just clarifying that the requirements on an employer can be met if they have a contract with the school that says that the school is going to take care of those background studies, and that the employer can get a copy of it if they want, and that the school agrees to tell them if anything changes regarding that person's status that we've informed them of. The Section 47 is related to subpoenas that our agency gets from time to time. And we probably do about 24 of these a year, 24, 25. And it's making it clear that when we subpoena, for instance, like bank records, that the subject of the records is not informed that the subpoena has been issued or that they've provided those records. In a case where typically when we're doing that kind of thing is we're investigating perhaps a provider who is most often it's a child care provider who is engaged in child care assistance fraud of one sort or another. And they have employees who are not, that's sort of a fictitious employment arrangement. And so they give the individual a check stub to show the county to verify their continued eligibility in the CCAP program. But we know that the individual is not actually getting paid. They're getting paid a much smaller amount of cash. to stay home and take care of their kids at home while the employer is collecting child care assistance. What this is doing is it allows us, when we do these subpoenas, to get the bank records of the provider to see whether or not they're actually making any payroll, that they're not going to be informed at that time. Those are the provisions of Article 4.
Madam Chair. Thank you very much. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kerber, just going quickly back to the background checks, if you could just get me the number of how many multi-state offender folks that you have, it will tell me whether it's a one-person problem or a 5,000-person problem.
Can you get that information, Representative or Mr. Kerber?
Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom certainly will.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Please come forward. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, members of the committee, Chairman Scott. My name is Mark Fidler. I'm an attorney, an Indian attorney, and I'm here on behalf of the American Academy of Adoption Attorneys. That's a 500-member organization of adoption attorneys from around the United States. I'm also the co-chair of our ICWA committee. We deal with all the Indian Child Welfare Act issues in the academy. I'm also the founder of the Indian Child Welfare Act Law Center right here in Minnesota back in 94. So I've got a long background in the Indian Child Welfare Act. And I also want to put in context some of my concerns about, I believe it's the first article, and if you go to page 11 of the bill, it talks about the purposes behind the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act. And this is a big bill, and there's just a couple little words in there that have profound consequences, and I wanted to make sure the committee was absolutely aware of what the implications are of the bill. There's been a debate throughout the courts in the United States, and most recently in the United States Supreme Court. I had a case before the United States Supreme Court, adoptive couple versus baby girl, and Justice Alito, Roberts, Thomas, Breyer, and Kennedy held that the Indian Child Welfare Act cannot be applied so as to override the child's best interests. So there was this question mark, can the child's best interest be considered in Indian Child Welfare Act proceedings? The Supreme Court clearly said yes, and if you don't consider those best interests independently, it would violate the Equal Protection Clause. Indian children are members of tribes, but they're also citizens of the state of Minnesota and the United States, and they are deserving of equal protection. So where does that leave us? Since adoptive couple was decided, there's been a concerted effort by tribal groups around the country to change the scales that are used in Indian Child Welfare Act proceedings by defining child's best interests according to the viewpoint of the tribe. And that's exactly what's going on in this bill. So on page 11, line 11, it says the purposes of this act are to protect the long-term interests as defined by the tribes of Indian children. And so the problem with that, and also if you go down to subdivision 2A, that's page 11, lines 30 and 31, it says the best interest of an Indian child means compliance with Indian Child Welfare Act and the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act. It says nothing about the child having the right to an independent determination of what his or her best interests are. So this language is here for a reason. I litigate these cases all the time. And what is going to happen, and the reason that tribal groups want this in here, is so they can march into state court proceedings. We're not talking about cases on the reservation. In state court proceedings, this will tell the judge that of all the evidence they hear about the child's best interests, that evidence which is relevant is the child's best interest as defined by the tribe. And the American Academy believes that this is a violation of equal protection. If I was a state judge, I would be... Pardon my iPad. It's a little grandiose, I know, but you know, a state judge would be horrified to know that their right to make a determination about what the child's best interests are is now taken away from them and you know, co-opted by the tribes. And so the tribes, I understand and respect tribal sovereignty. The tribes already under the Indian Child Welfare Act, under the Indian Family Preservation Act, if they want to take a case into tribal court, they can do that. They just have to make a motion for transfer. The parents don't object. The case goes to tribal court, and the tribe, under its own laws, can determine what the child's best interests are any way they please. But we're talking about cases in state court involving Minnesota children, United States citizens who have the right to equal protection. And we think for those reasons, the Academy, that the bill is fine overall. We just have to go, and I would urge you to tinker with this language and delete the phrase, the clause as defined by the tribe, and insert a provision on line 30 stating that the child has the right to an independent best interest consideration. So I'd be happy to take any questions.
Member questions for this testifier? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Okay,
thank you.
Okay, welcome to the committee. Are you here to testify for or against the bill, or are you from a department, or go ahead and state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Rebecca McConkey-Green. I'm an attorney that works with the Whiter Band of Ojibwe, and I'm here to testify on behalf of the bill.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill has come about after a great amount of work on the tribes in Minnesota, and especially over this last year with the Minnesota County Attorneys Association and the County Social Service Directors. We met, I think, almost monthly on this bill, and we've worked very hard to come up with language that would help to remove some of the disparities that you heard about earlier for Indian children in Minnesota. After many meetings, we came to consensus on the language in the bill that's before you, and so there has been a great deal of state and county involvement in this bill. The Department of Human Services was, of course, involved as well. Involvement of the family's tribe in child protection proceedings has been proven to be very successful, and this is one of the things that this bill is very aimed at doing. It looks at getting notice to the children's tribes quickly and at the very first part of contact when there's reports to the agencies and they go out to assess. We're hoping that there will be more involvement with tribes to help plan for the family and determine services at that time. Under this, there was an initiative that was done in 2007 with child welfare services on both the White Earth and Leech Lake reservations, and that had some success. It resulted in children having better permanency options, being moved less frequently during child protection proceedings, and most often if they did have to go to permanency, resulting in situations where children were in permanency with their families much more often than in state court proceedings generally, and if not, then with other tribal members. I wanted to specifically talk a little bit about the testimony that you just heard from Mr. Fiddler. I would point out that the purpose statement is where the language is, that he's referring to is located, and that is designed to help guide the courts as they're looking at child protection proceedings. One of the most important things for the courts to look at as they're going through these proceedings is that Indian children have a different relationship with their tribe than they experience anywhere else. Their tribe will be something that they're a part of all throughout their lives, whereas the state of Minnesota or the particular county that they're in at that time may not be. The language that's objected to is in the policy statement specifically to highlight that unique relationship with the tribe. And this language specifically was agreed upon by the Minnesota County Attorneys Association and the County Social Service Directors, the Department of Human Services, and the tribe. The best interest definition is not something that's unusual. There is already best interest definitions within the Minnesota Child Protection Statutes. There's more than one. And the best interest definition for Indian children is meant simply to supplement that definition and ensure that we're including the correct cultural and tribal needs that child has. And those needs are real, and they do need to be considered in these proceedings. So this is not something that is in any way depriving Indian children of the same rights of other children in Minnesota. It's making sure that all of their rights and all of their needs are recognized correctly as we go through child protection proceedings.
And to the testifier, just wondering, which set of factors trumps the other then? Do would the supplemental best interest of the Indian child trump the current statute, Minnesota statute, for best interest factors? How does that work?
My understanding is the best interest factors are weighed by, you know, and so it's difficult to answer that overall because each case may be different individually. For example, if you have a child that has some specific medical needs that can't be met in other circumstances, that's probably going to trump everything else, right? But if you have, but other situations may result in those best interest factors being weighed differently. I don't think that we can answer that broadly. It certainly is an important consideration and should be weighed, you know, equally, at least, with the other considerations.
Okay. So really, maybe the question, I ask it wrong, because this is child protection. So Minnesota statutes require regarding CHIPS is probably the statute that we're looking at here. And so which of those would trump? Would the CHIPS standards trump the Indian Child Welfare Act and the best interest of the Indian child, or vice versa?
I think it's a matter of working in concert with those statutes. As I'm recalling, Minnesota Chapter 260C, which is where the best interest factors are laid out, I think, a couple of times within that statute, this is designed to work in concert with those, and there's parts of those that have been added to as well.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing no one, any further member questions? Representative Mack, we'll give you the last word.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The department did a great job, and I appreciate the support of the committee.
Thank you so much for bringing this bill forward. I would like to renew my motion that House File 1535, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way. Thank you, Representative Mack. The next bill up is my bill. I will just invite the testifiers to the table. I'll sit in my seat here. It's House File 1539. And Mr. Kerber, I believe, is going to be testifying on this. And my motion is that House File 1535 be re-referred to the General Register. Mr. Kerber, if you could address the bill for us and do a walkthrough, that would be appreciated.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jerry Kerber. I'm the head of the Inspector General's Office of the Department of Human Services. And this is the Department's Data Practices Bill. And so I'll walk through it. There are 13 sections. The first section is a minor change to the definition of which agencies are considered welfare agencies for purposes of data sharing. Most of the activity in the Department of Human Services falls under Chapter 13 in Section 4.6, which governs welfare data, as it's called. And so you heard from the previous bill about tribal organizations that are involved in more and more social services, human services. And so this is just allowing the department and the tribal agencies to share that data to the extent that it's identified in the interagency agreements. Section 2 of the bill is a provision that allows the department to share information during the course of an investigation with law enforcement agencies or other investigative agencies. The legislature already made it clear that we can share this data, this private data, with those other investigative agencies as needed for them to carry out that work. However, technically, during the course of an investigation, the data is classified as confidential. And so this is just what we see as sort of a housekeeping provision to make that more clear. The next section is... In Section 3 is related to child care assistance, and what you'll see in this bill, I think this section doesn't really stand alone. This section refers to some new language. It's a cross-reference, and so the new language will be in another section I'll talk about in a moment. But generally what we're doing is we're changing the classification of some information regarding child care assistance as it relates to how much child care assistance a child care provider is receiving as reimbursing them for the care they provide. The section 4 is a provision that also relates to section 10 of the bill. And this allows the department to enter into an interagency agreement with the Department of Revenue for the exchange of some data. We can already get some information from the Department of Revenue to verify eligibility for people in Minnesota Care. What this is doing is allowing us to expand the interagency agreement with them to get information to verify the eligibility of other people on medical assistance. When you look at Section 10, the data fields that we're talking about are very clearly identified. Section 5 of the bill relates to Social Security number, and this has to do with the fact that the medical assistance program the department operates is to be the payer of last resort for medical coverage. And so when individuals are in traffic accidents and they're injured, the insurance companies involved should be paying for those medical costs. And so what this is allowing is that in those cases when somebody presents for medical treatment and the injury that they have is related to an accident, in those cases the department would be able to verify that this was a traffic accident through that exchange of data. Section 6 of the bill is the one where I talked about that we're changing some of the classification of the data so that we can release a little more data regarding child care assistance when there's fraudulent activity involved. What we want to be able to do is if we are investigating a child care provider for inappropriate billing, that we could say how much public assistance that employer and that child care provider is receiving by the department, and then talk about how much of it we determine to be fraudulent. The law is very protective of that information now, and very differently, and treats it very differently than medical assistance data, where we can easily say, you know, how much a PCA provider is receiving or how much a hospital gets in public funding. But this is more sensitive because it's identifying, in some cases, that an individual family may be getting child care assistance, and that's more protected. And so there's language in there that also says that if this would disclose the identity of an individual family, then it would remain public or remain private with the department. Then in Section 7, we get into the background study of law, Chapter 245C. And what we're doing here is related to the change that I mentioned with the previous bill, where we're converting over to a system of background studies that are based not on first, middle, last name anymore, but based on people's fingerprint comparison. When we get fingerprints from an individual, we're going to be asking, you know, every individual who's applying for employment out there to give their fingerprints through our system and get their photograph taken. That was passed by the legislature last year. What we're doing here is saying that if that individual is less than 18 years old, we want to require that the consent of the parent or the person responsible for that minor is going to give that consent. Section 8 has two parts to it. The first part has to do with when somebody is getting fingerprinted, if they apply for a job with an employer and the employer is able to submit identifying information into our online system, it's called NetStudy, the person then has to go to a fingerprint station to get fingerprinted. And there wasn't a timeline on here, and we learned from some other states that it's good to have a timeline on here so that people actually follow up on that. Sometimes employers are left kind of hanging because they think that this person is going to go get their fingerprints recorded, and they don't. So we're saying that to bring closure to the system, they have 14 days. You'll see in the amendment that there's some clarifying language that if the person doesn't show up by 7 days, we're going to inform the employer that the person hasn't shown up yet 7 days so they can prompt the person to go. And then if that person at the end of 14 days needs an extension on that period of time for good cause, the commissioner can grant that. So that's also in Section 9. But the other part of Section 8 that's important for this committee is that we're adding a requirement that When the counties do background studies, and they do background studies now only on family child care providers, all other DHS licensed programs or health department licensed programs and programs licensed by the Department of Corrections, those all come to the Department of Human Services. There's one carve out left with counties doing background studies on family child care providers. So while we have converted are converting our system to be fingerprint based, the counties are not. And so what happens is that the counties, as I mentioned with the previous bill, we rely on that field of data at the BCA that indicates whether somebody's a single state offender or not, or a multi-state offender. The BCA, under the advice of the FBI, has been told that they can't give that information out anymore. The law didn't change, but the interpretation changed. That's giving out too much information that the FBI has without the benefit of fingerprints. And so what we came up with here is mirroring some language in for other background studies that says that if somebody hasn't lived in this state for the previous 5 years, then we'll do an FBI record check on those people. And so then all the other conditions of the background study law apply. Then I mentioned that number 9, section 10 of the bill and section 11 are very similar, and these involve data that we get from the Department of Public Safety. The Department was a Drazkowski bill a couple years ago that required the Department of Public Safety to give us information in the first issue there when somebody has multiple driver's licenses with the same face. So the Public Safety did a review of their data using facial recognition software, and they determined that there are some individuals who have multiple driver's license and ID cards with totally different information on, but they have the same face on them. And so when they discover that information, then they're required to give that to the Department of Human Services so we can verify whether or not there's a false identity that's being used to enroll in any of the public programs. What we need to do in this case is to get the Social Security number from the winnowing down, because getting somebody's name from Public Safety and even their facial image doesn't really help us when we're comparing the database information. The second one, section 10 or section 11 is very similar to that, and it was also a result of the same 2013 session where we're getting from the Department of Public Safety when they terminate somebody's driver's license because their legal presence is terminated, and so the driver's license is ended because they're no longer here legally, possibly. Then in those cases, the Department of Public Safety is required to give us that information. And so we're saying that what we'd like to get with that is a Social Security number so we can compare it more meaningfully against our database. The number 12 here is, again, related to that data sharing that I mentioned earlier, that this is the actual language for the data sharing agreement that the department can enter into with the Department of Revenue for us to get some specific information. We're not asking for people's tax returns or anything like that, just some fields of data, really to verify the income that they've reported. And then Section 13 is a provision in the state's Vulnerable Adult Act, and the Vulnerable Adult Act that has pretty much, since 1995, had a provision that says that each county is responsible for establishing a common entry point, and that's the phone number that receives calls from anybody in that county who may have a concern about that there might be maltreatment, abuse, neglect, or financial abuse of a vulnerable adult. What happened, the legislature passed a provision that says that all of those 87 systems will be combined into one by the Department of Human Services. And so that's being built right now. And so when the Department of Human Services becomes the single common entry point for the state, this is a kind of a housekeeping change to the Data Practices Act, or excuse me, Data Practices Provisions of the Vulnerable Adult Act that allow the department to share that information as necessary then back to the counties for purposes of investigation.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That too was my bill. So you're paying attention to the Commerce Committee budget bill as well, are you not? Because they have provisions that they want folks to report stuff to them. And given the language that, of course, we want everybody reporting to the same place, I want to make sure that the department is actually monitoring what other departments are doing to make sure that this doesn't conflict with those other bills.
Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom, I know there are people in the department who are paying close attention to that. I don't know kind of the status of our interrelationship with that new reporting requirement and new investigation requirement, and where there, I think there have been certainly conversations about that there may be some overlap here. But I my understanding is that those issues are being worked on. I haven't personally been involved.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Kerber, we actually have the chair of the Commerce Committee, so part of this question is to make sure that he's paying attention as well to that particular issue. So,
Representative Hoppe?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hillstrom. And actually, this part of the budget is in the Jobs and Energy Finance Committee.
Do you serve on that, Representative Hoppe?
Representative Hillstrom, I do not.
Representative Hillstrom, I do.
Oh, thank you. So I'm very concerned about that particular piece because we all want all the information to go through the number so people call one place.
So noted. Thank you, Representative.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I was just informed that our agency is working with them on the language that's being developed to make sure that there isn't overlap, yet it's very thorough.
Good. Other member questions? Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kerber, there is a lot of stuff in here. This is a big, bill. And I look at it, it's got at least what I think would be half a dozen or more provisions that could be their own bill very easily. And I question as to whether we have enough time to actually digest and get the implications of everything that you're doing here. Now, my first question involves, I had former Senator Berglund in my office earlier in the session because Hennepin County Public Health wanted to, or Health Department, whatever their division is called over there, wanted to be able to do some of the same things which I think you're proposing in here. Was she testifying, or was she speaking to me on a provision in this bill? Have you been in communication with her or Hennepin County Health on this?
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, I don't know what you may have talked with her about. I know she was involved in the GRH bill and background study provisions of that, and I know I've talked with her about that. But I don't know specifically as it relates to any of the provisions in this bill that sort of intersect with that, other than just sort of general background study expectations.
Representative Lesh, I can speak to the Berglund bill, which is Representative Zerwas carrying that, and it was wanting to get, without consent, wanting to have the sharing of information for people, especially that are indigent or homeless, and they have a hard time following up on those people because they're hard to locate. I was not comfortable with that because of the lack of consent.
I didn't, Madam Chair, I don't want to get anything started between you and Representative Zerwas here. But I do have questions about this, but I actually, because I haven't looked at this thoroughly, I don't have any other questions today. I noticed that it went through Health and Human Services without much discussion either. But we are, I was talking with Representative Hillstrom, and we're making some changes that aren't necessarily consistent with our other moves in this committee, in this bill. So no other comments on that, Madam Chair, other than the fact that I don't feel like we have enough time to digest the totality of all the provisions in this.
Representative Lesh, I would be glad to work with y'all between now and then. And if we find provisions that we just can't live with, and we find provisions we just can't live with. So what I'd like to do is actually, I'd like to lay this bill over, actually, because I think there are some provisions here that I'm not completely comfortable with, and it went through DHS, and Representative Mack, who's the co-author, presented the bill. And she doesn't have the background that we do, so I think that's what I'd like to do at this point. Although, if I do that, then I... Let's talk about it today and see what we can come up with, and then we'll discuss it tonight again when we meet. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Where else does it go?
It's right. It goes to the general register from here, so that's why I want to get it taken care of. So, thank you, Mr. Gerber.
Thank you.
We'll be laying this bill over. Representative Baker, you're next. Oops. Oh, I'm sorry. I guess it is 10 o'clock on the dot. My regrets. I apologize to those of you that have waited all morning. What we're going to do is recess until immediately after session. Then we will be meeting in room 300 North. 300 North immediately following session. We are in recess.
Where are you going to take?
We're going to reconvene the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee. Representative Baker, I will move House File 1792 to be re-referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee, and again, I want to apologize. You're not a bee squatter, okay? You're the one who actually brought it to me, but we have a nursing home receivership bill in front of you, and actually, if I could, Madam Chair, we do have a small oral amendment, and if I could point that out quick, I'd like to enter that in as well as an author's amendment.
Yes, go ahead.
Line 3.29, starting with the word including payments for services and provided before the receivership should be deleted. So those eight words should be deleted, starting with including and ending with the word receivership.
Alrighty.
And that was a recommendation by some stakeholders.
Okay.
And
staff have that.
Okay.
The chair will waive the rule, the 72-hour or the 24-hour rule on amendments. 72 now. Yeah, we know that a lot of notice. Any other discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the oral amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Amendment is adopted. To your bill, Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, House File 1792 is about nursing home receiverships, which, in a good way, doesn't happen very often. However, over the past 10 years, there have been a few receiverships that have affected five nursing homes, and out of these receiverships, two nursing homes have closed. Two have stayed open, and one is currently ongoing. There's just a couple provisions with this, and I think I'll just have my testifier, Darcy, step in now. And so we are perfect timing.
All right.
So, Madam Chair, we're ready to go with our testimony, and we're ready to go.
All right. Yeah. Welcome to the committee. I'll give you a second to catch your breath there, and when you're ready, just state your name for the record and continue on with your testimony, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Darcy Miner, and I am the Director of Health Regulation at the Minnesota Department of Health. And Madam Chair, I don't need to go into any great detail. I just want to summarize that the purpose of the bill for the Department of Health, at least, is to try and shorten the amount of time between when we determine that a situation is so egregious that we need to go into a nursing home and the time that we actually then can get our managing agent on site to protect the health and safety of the residents there. I will certainly answer any questions, Madam Chair, that you or the members have.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any member questions? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 1792 be re-referred to the General Register as amended. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way. Thank you, Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee, and have a great week, Easter.
You do the same. Thank you. Representative Mullery. Oh, no.
I'll go grab it. All right.
Here we go.
All right.
See the one up.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh will move House File 1688 and recommend that it be re-referred to State Government Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
To your bill.
Madam Chair, what we're doing is just trying to bring this one statute into compliance with the standard statute of limitations under most cases under Minnesota law. Under most cases, minors can't bring an action on their own when the event happens. So unless their guardian or something brings it for them, they have to wait till they're an adult. And under this law, if we don't extend it, they can't bring it at all. So we are just complying with the rest of most of civil law in Minnesota, where you have a minor has 1 year after they turn to the age of majority to bring a case on their behalf. And with me, we have Scott Butel from the Department of Human Rights.
Go ahead with your testimony, Mr. Butel, if you want to introduce yourself first, please.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Scott Butel. I'm the legislative liaison with Minnesota Department of Human Rights. House File 1688 is a Department of Human Rights agency bill that touches on tolling of claims by minors, so it deals with the statute of limitations, as Representative Mullery said, This would bring the Minnesota Human Rights Act into line with the kind of general scheme of the civil law provisions in the state of Minnesota. Currently, the Human Rights Act has a one-year statute of limitations, but is silent on the issue of how this would affect minors. In general, in Chapter 54115, the general civil law statute that deals with statute of limitations, it tolls the claim of a minor, so it stops the clock from running until they turn 18. What this bill would do is it would not prevent a parent or guardian from filing a claim on a minor's behalf, but what it would also mean is the statute of limitations wouldn't start running until their 18th birthday, and then they would be able to file a claim from 18 to 19, from 18 until they turn 19. And what this would functionally do is it would give that minor and their family a little bit more flexibility in terms of the timing of how they file that claim. The number of claims filed on behalf of minors by the agency is relatively small. In 2014, I believe there were 6 claims filed with the department. In 2015 so far, there have been 2 charges. So it's not a huge number of charges, but I think for the individuals that it affects, it can be fairly significant given that minors are sort of more vulnerable to community pressure and whatnot. I think giving them and their families a little bit more latitude in terms of how they file that charge makes a lot of sense. And doing this conformity with the rest of civil law, I think, makes a lot of sense. So I hope I can answer any questions the committee has.
Sure. Mr. Butel, is there a minimum age at which a child can file a suit? Go ahead. Mr. Butel.
So the minimum age at which an individual could file a suit is the age of 18. For right now, under the Act, a parent or guardian could bring a claim on behalf of a minor, I believe, at any age.
Well, I understand that. I didn't word the question correctly. If the parents were going to file on behalf of the child, is there a minimum age? If they're 5 years old, do you file a suit, or do they have to be? Representative Mullery?
Madam Chair, the parents could, or a guardian could.
Okay. All right. Any other member questions? Seeing none. Representative Lesch renews his motion that House File 1688 be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion is adopted. Thank you, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you.
Representative Albright. We're going to scooch in. Representative Lohmer will move House File 1976. And this bill will be going to Job Growth, Energy, and Affordability.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the Dolly bill for the work comp. Legislation that we typically take up in the first session of most every biennium. The sections that pertain to this committee are found on page 2, lines 2.9 through 2.16, as well as 2.34 through 2.36. And with that, I'm just wondering, Madam Chair, if you would indulge me in asking House Legal to go over those two sections for us.
I'm sorry, Representative Alder. I was having a hard time hearing you. What were you asking for?
I just was wondering if legal counsel could just review those two sections for the members
certainly.
Of the committee.
Certainly. Ms. Mullen.
Chair and representatives, in this bill, the first part that Representative Albright points to is at 2.9. And it has to do with the medical records and reports that are used in workers' compensation claims and the fact that those records can now be used in an electronic format. And then the second portion has to do with a monetary fine that's imposed related to workers' compensation.
Thank you, Ms. Mullen. Representative Albright, do you have a testifier there that's come prepared with remarks, or is he phone a friend? Or
no, Madam Chair, I have Chris Blackfield from Dolly to make remarks to the work that's been done to bring, as we've heard in the years past, peace in the valley thus far with the work between labor and industry on this particular piece of legislation.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Blackfield.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Chris Lightfield. I'm Assistant Commissioner in the Department of Labor and Industry.
And just broadly, the bill you're looking at is a bill, the legislation was approved by the Work Comp Advisory Council on March 11, 2015. And the three sections you're looking at, one addresses electronic billing and payment. Second section addresses electronic funds transfer, monetary benefits of an injured worker, if requested by the injured worker. And a third section amends reporting requirements when there's a hospitalization or fatality to the Department of Labor and Industry. I believe the section you're looking at relates to, as was noted, the section related to the attachment requirement that's in the legislation. The attachment is 275. The electronic transaction process is something is in statute 62J536, which is overseen by the Department of Health. Issues, there are particular issues that workers' compensation faces in terms of gathering enough information to make the determination on the billing and the payment of worker compensation claims. What we're trying to do here, and what the effort here is to make the workers' compensation payment claim and payment process more efficient and have the parties participate and be active in the process. In this particular section, the requirement is that the providers must submit copies of their medical records using this transaction, the 275 transaction, and then in return the payer sends it back using the same transaction tool. There is a penalty involved, as with the other three pieces of that section, and the penalty is a $500 fine, which may be assessed by the department if there is a violation, and there is an initial warning for that violation, and if it continues the identical violations, the penalty may assess up to $25,000 in a calendar year.
Thank you, Mr. Liefeld. Are there any member questions? Seeing none, I just want to verify for the record, Representative Albright, that the A-15 is, you don't intend to offer that.
Madam Chair, we do not. At this time, I'm not going to be offering or requesting an add-on of the A-15.
All right, thank you. Seeing no further member questions, is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing no one, Representative Loewer renews her motion that House File 1967 be re-referred to the Job Growth, Energy, and Affordability Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way. Thank you, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
What I'd like to do now, members, is we're going to go back to House File 1539. That was the department's, the DHS data bill. Are the testifiers in the room for that? Oh, there he is, Mr. Gerber. And what I'd like to do is, you should have amendments, folks, that were passed out. If I could bother one of the pages to get me a copy of the A1, I don't seem to. Does everyone else have an A1, A2, and A3 to this bill, the 1539?
A3, A2, and A3.
Yeah.
OK. Okay, so maybe we need some more A1s passed out. I'm not sure who left the stack of...
The A1s or A-wall.
Is that them? Oh, those are for 210. So we will get the A1 passed out, the A1 to 1539, and we'll hit all three of them. Does everybody have the A1? Okay. All right, Mr. Kerber, if you could go to the address the A1, and then I'll cover the other two since those came from me. Thank
okay,
you. Go
Madam
ahead.
Chair.
Introduce yourself for the tape, please.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the head of the Inspector General's Office of the Department of Human Services. And so the A1 amendment follows some conversation during and after the earlier hearing this morning, talking about the provision in the bill. There's a couple little sections that talk about our ability, the Department of Human Services' ability to enter into an interagency agreement with the Department of Commerce, through which we would be getting some information. And I said Commerce, I meant the Department of Revenue. So from the Department of Revenue, we'd be getting some select information that would allow us to verify the eligibility based on income of individuals who are enrolled in medical assistance. What this provision does is it simply makes sure that at the time that individuals are enrolling, we're informing them of that, and that through their continued application, they're hereby giving consent to our accessing that information.
Thank you. Any discussion on the A1? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A1 is adopted. The A2 and the A3, I worked with staff on this afternoon. Mr. Gehring, would you want to go through those with the members, please?
Madam Chair and members, the H-1539-A2 amendment is an amendment that would add a new subdivision to the section of the Data Practices Act related to the welfare system. And the language that's in this amendment is similar to language that's been added into the sections related to MNsure, and then also you saw it in the automated license plate reader bill that requires the agencies to include an audit trail and other tracking capabilities with their databases so that they can verify the individuals who are accessing data and for what purpose.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Mr. Kerber, did you get a chance to look at this?
Madam Chair, I'm looking at it real quickly here.
Okay, I'll be quiet while you read.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While he's reading, if I could get some clarification on the line 1.12 through line 1.19, if the patient has provided annual consent, to what? What are they now going to be consenting to?
Are you referring to the bill or to the amendment?
Are we on the A2 amendment?
Yes.
Yes. So on the A2 amendment, lines 1.2 to 1.9, it starts... if the patient has provided annual consent, what are they consenting to on each of these lines?
I think you're on the A2 to a different bill. It should say H1539A2.
Thank you. Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So now that I'm reading the correct amendment, mm-hmm. on line 1.16, do we typically permanently revoke? So I understand we must immediately revoke, but do we usually put in statute and permanently revoke?
If I think you still have the wrong amendment.
I'm on the H1539A2.
1.6?
On line 1.16.
Oh, 1.6, I'm sorry.
It says, must be immediately and permanently revoked. So I understand the immediately. I'm just not sure if we usually make that and permanently revoke. That's consistent with other places in
statute. Representative Hillstrom, this is consistent with the Minshew language and the LPR data. The LPR language.
I just want to make sure and permanently revoke is in there.
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair and members, having had a chance to look at this, I too was looking at the wrong bill amendment. But I think the general concept, I think, of being held accountable for properly handling public data is not something that's contrary to anything the department would be concerned about. The only one is on line 12. If there could be a slight amendment, not all of the data systems that we're operating in today have, to my understanding, have good capability for doing the type of auditing and tracking as would be required in this system. And so if there were to be an amendment to the extent allowable by the data systems that are currently operated by the department, I think you've heard that some of the systems we're operating preceded even the invention of a mouse. We have some really old systems in place. And so to the extent that it can be done and as new systems are developed, and so like our new background study system is certainly going to have this capability. And as new systems are rolled out, they all do. But some of the older systems that we're operating may not have that.
Mr. Kerber, this morning you and I had a conversation post the committee hearing, and you were talking about the fact that you had to let four employees go because they were looking at driver's license data. So the system on which you have driver's license data, is that one of the antiquated systems you're talking about?
Madam Chair, that is one of the systems that's being replaced right now. That's one of the systems that's the older system did not have adequate tracking, but the newer system is. So we have a new background study system that we're rolling out, and that one does have it.
Okay, and when do you, what's your best guess of when that's going to be up and running?
Excuse me. Madam Chair, we're operating it with pilot providers right now, and so the statutory deadline is September, and we certainly intend to meet that. We're looking at rolling this out fairly aggressively in midsummer. But that's, Madam Chair, that's one of many, many systems at the department.
What I'd like to do here then, Mr. Kerber, could we delay the effective date of this bill until all those audit trail safety nets are in place? I just think in today's day and age, an audit trail is something that we really need to have when we're handling this really, really sensitive information and personal information. So let's see, what is the effective date of the actual bill? I'm assuming it might be after final enactment, but probably have it. Oh, it's in the statute.
Madam Chair, I believe most of these provisions were August 1st.
August 1st. So if we give you till January 1st of 2016, we change the effective date to that time?
Madam Chair, I think that would be a reasonable thing to do here today, and we'll keep working on this.
All right.
And
get
more informed.
So we'll make an oral amendment, because I don't know. I think it doesn't really specify in here, does it? And if it doesn't, then the default is August 1st. So we'll change that to January 1st of 2016. Okay. Any other discussion on the A2 from members? Seeing none, all those in favor? Oops. Oh, okay. Let's vote on the oral amendment.
Can I just say something?
Yes. Mr. Gearing.
Madam Chair, just to clarify, so the intent of the committee then would be to make the entire bill effective January 1st, 2016. And I just want to point out that there are a couple of sections in the bill currently that that's provide for immediate effective dates. And so by adopting the oral amendment, you'd be deleting those immediate effective dates.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe we should do the delayed effective date on the A2 amendment rather than on the entire bill. I just don't know if there's other protections that we're putting in that we're going to be delaying protections, and you ultimately want to put additional protections in where possible. But if this section is the only one that's causing difficulty to comply with, maybe just make the effective date on this piece.
We can do that. I think, does that work, Mr. Geary?
Yeah, so Madam Chair, then you could orally amend the A2 amendment to add a line after 1.18. This section is effective January 1st, 2016.
Madam Chair?
Mr. Kerber.
I'm just reminded that with an effective date, there may be a cost to this. If there is a need for some system change to allow for this auditing function to be added to the system. Mm-hmm.
Well, Mr. Kerber, we can change the motion to send it to HHS Finance. Would that work?
Sure.
Okay, we will change that motion then. All right. So the motion is to amend the A2 to change the effective date to January 1st, 2016. All those in favor of that oral amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment to the amendment is adopted. Now to the A2. All those in favor of the A2, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A2 is adopted. Mr. Gearing, did you already cover the A3? We haven't covered the language in the A3, is that right?
Madam Chair and members, the A3 amendment is actually language that came from Mr. Kerber. So
yes, it did. Mr. Kerber, would you like to address that? I believe it addresses possibly Representative Hillstrom's concerns from this morning.
Madam Chair, that's what we're attempting to do here, is to address an issue raised by Representative Hillstrom as it related to a couple provisions in the other bill where, in the policy bill, where we are decreasing the need for repeat background studies on individuals because we are getting information from the Minnesota Court Information System on a regular basis. However, as Representative Hillstrom pointed out, sometimes, you know, one of the benefits of doing repeat background studies with the department, with BCA data, is that there may have been an update of the multi-state offender status because of some activity in another state. And so if an individual committed a crime in another state, then they came back to Minnesota and they committed a crime here, we would get that information out of MNCIS, but we wouldn't know about the other crime that they committed in the other state. So this amendment simply makes it clear that in those cases where we get something from the MNCIS system, we will in every case then just do a double check with the BCA to see if the individual's multi-state offender status has changed since the last time we looked at it.
Thank you, Mr. Kerber. Representative Hillstrom, are you noodling that, or are you thinking that's an okay idea?
Madam Chair, thank you for addressing this issue. This gets us closer to where we are today. It certainly doesn't make the system perfect, but it has moved us in a better direction.
Very fine. All those in favor of adopting the A3, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. The remainder of the bill, folks, is in the same shape that it was when we left it this morning. Is there any further discussion on House File 1539? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, all those in favor of sending House File 1539, have it re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Thank you, Mr. Kerber.
Thank
you, Madam
Chair.
Appreciate your cooperation on this. Representative Hillstrom, would you like to present your bill?
Oh, sure.
And we'll try to get a hold of Representative Schoen to get him down here next.
Madam Chair, where does it go?
This bill is going to the General Register.
Okay, great. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, House File 1647 really addresses the issue that I lost my notes.
In the meantime, would you like to move your bill, Representative Hilstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 1647 be sent to the General Register.
Very good.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, medical debt is a serious and growing problem in America and in Minnesota, and it places thousands of Minnesotans and their family in financial jeopardy. Recent data from the collections industry indicate that 75 million Americans, 41% of adults age 19 to 64, reporting having medical debt or having trouble paying medical bills. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau recently found that medical debt has a distorted impact on credit scores, and the Bureau found that because of credit scoring modeling, the credit worthiness of consumers with medical debt was underestimated by 10 points and by 22 points for consumers who paid the debt off. And according to a recent story in The Atlantic, which is in your packet, the medical debt is the number one cause of personal bankruptcy and is responsible for more collections than credit cards. The IRS recently enacted rules for nonprofit hospitals requiring them to tell patients of their financial aid policy and any available charity care or hospital payment plans before they can make a medical lien for closing on a patient's home, freezing a patient's bank account, or garnishing the patient's wages, suing the patients, or selling the debt to a debt buyer. So the problem is that individual patients harmed by violations to either the rules or the settlement has absolutely no recourse under state or federal law. So this bill provides some modest resource by allowing patients to go to court and ask a judge to enjoin extraordinary collection actions, and that term is defined by IRS rules. So if the patient shows that he or she was subject to one of those collection actions without ever getting information required under those IRS rules about the financial aid policy of the hospital. So there would be no monetary penalties assessed, no damages, no civil fines. However, if the patient proves a violation of the law, the patient would be entitled to reasonable attorney's fees. So there's no public opposition to the bill that I know of. I want to acknowledge that the Minnesota Hospital Association and the Minnesota Association of Collectors helped constructively work on this bill. I have Rick Barco with SEIU Healthcare to testify in support of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Hilstrom. Do you have a testifier here? Go ahead and introduce your name for the tape and go ahead with your testimony, please.
Chairwoman Scott, members of the committee, my name is Rick Varco. I'm the political director of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. One of our members, Monroe Von Ruden, works at Alina Hospital in Alina St. Francis Hospital in Shakopee. Her daughter was born with serious kidney issues and required 7 months of intensive hospital visits. Despite good health insurance, Monroe quickly ran up over $5,000 in medical bills. Her employer, Alina, turned this debt over to a collection agency. The agency got a legal judgment, and Monroe's wages were garnished $250 to $300 a pay period. After one of our staff alerted her to Alina's charity care policy, Partners Care, Monroe applied and found out she qualified. To their credit, Alina did the right thing very quickly, canceled her debt, and refunded her lost wages. Under the new IRS regulations, Alina would have been required to give Monroe written information on their charity care policy before they started extraordinary debt collection actions. These regulations might have saved Monroe a lot of anguish and heartache, and they might have saved Alina a lot of time, effort, and money. IRS rules, however, do not provide individuals with much of a remedy. The rules of a distant and blunt IRS do little for specific individual consumers who wind up in collections or courts. This bill would allow Monroe or someone in the same similar situation to ask a judge to stop collections until they got a copy of the charity care policy and had the opportunity to find out if they qualified. Just a couple of points about what's not in this bill. Most Minnesota nonprofit hospitals are run by very good people who want to do the right thing. We don't need this bill because bad people work there. We need this bill because they are large institutions under extraordinary pressure to generate revenue and collect on debts. This bill is a small additional check on what might be bad apples, and it will help prevent a race to the bottom in the industry. I also want to emphasize that this bill leaves hospitals in total control of their charity care policies. It doesn't require them to provide anyone with charity care, nor does it give anyone the power to reduce the amount of debt owed to them. This bill doesn't require hospitals to do anything they're not already required to do under federal regulations. It just gives local Minnesota judges the chance to hold local hospitals accountable in specific cases without waiting for a distant and slow-moving federal government to respond. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to make this really clear. It doesn't say that it's going to stop phone calls. It just says before they can take out a medical lien, before they can foreclose on the patient's home, before they can freeze the bank account, garnish the wage, sue the patient, or sell the debt to a debt buyer, they have to have done that. Or it allows the court to say you can't do those things until you provide the policy.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom, for that further explanation. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, just wondering if this is going to deal with the situation that I've had happen to me. I went to, had a physical for my diabetes, came home, paid my deductible when I went in there. About 30 days later, I get a collection notice. 31 days later, I get the bill. So before I even received the bill, my bill had gone to collections. Is this going to resolve that issue?
Mr. Barco.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't think this will help do a great deal to alleviate your situation. Under the new IRS regulations, you would have been required to get a copy of the charity care policy. If you had not gotten that copy, you could, if you got a, I didn't quite hear the story, would that count as extraordinary debt collection? Was it turned over to a debt collector already?
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, it already had been turned over to a debt collector, and I had not received my first bill.
In that situation, hypothetically, if that happened after, Representative, after the passage of this bill, if you had not gotten a copy of the hospital's charity care policy, you could have gone to a judge and said, please stop this until such time as I do get the charity care policy. Obviously, as a practical matter, you could call them up, tell them, you know, I suspect most of these things would be worked out prior to court.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And they haven't taken any extraordinary measures yet. They haven't tried to foreclose on your house. They haven't put a lien on your bank account. So there really isn't extraordinary measures at that point unless.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, just that going to the collections, it dings your credit report, and you had not received the bill.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, and I know this is an IRS chapter sort of a thing, that regulation that we're looking at, but at what point in the bill payment scheme of things does the hospital have to provide this charity language that you're talking about? If you know.
Madam Chair, I'm going to bring up a lawyer to answer your question.
All right. Sounds good. Well, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. To answer your question, the hospital, under the rules, can provide the notice of the available care at any point before they would take any of the actions that Representative Hillstrom's bill would prohibit, or the IRS rules prohibit. So there's not, it doesn't expressly say it has to be within X days, X hours of the entrance into the hospital, but they just can't take these extra measures prior to letting people know that there may be availability of charity care or a payment plan.
Okay, I just want to make sure that when you get your first bill that it's not included in that. It's on down the line from there. Okay. Very good.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair and members, it ought to be before you get your first bill. It ought to be while you're in the hospital.
Oh, okay. All right. Representative Hillstrom, anybody else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing no one, any other member questions? Seeing none, Representative Hillstrom, do you want to have the final word there?
Thank you. I think this is a great bill, so I would ask that members support it and send House File 1647 to the House floor.
Very good. Members, all those in favor of re-referring House File 1647 to the General Register, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank
motion
you,
is
members.
Approved. Representative Schoen, House File 506.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Is this going to the, where are we going to the floor with this, or are we going somewhere
this
here?
Is going to State Gov Finance, Representative Schoen.
Okay. Madam Chair, members, I saw I'd move House File 506 be re-referred to
State Government Finance.
Yeah, State Government Finance. So this bill is pertaining to temporary licensure for members of the military, former members of the military, and then their family members. The reason that it's in front of us today is because there's language about background checks. The temporary licenses in here don't have current authority to issue temporary license. They currently have the ability to do the background checks, have the infrastructure in place to do it, and the policies, but that is what we need to talk about, is to give them the authority to do it for their new temporary licenses that they're going to be able to do for veterans. Haven't had any issues in any other committees, and I'd appreciate your support for the bill.
Thank you, Representative Schoen. Sounds like a good bill. Is your testifier here prepared to make comments, or just if we have questions?
If you have questions, absolutely. Otherwise, she's more than happy to head for home.
Okay. All right. Any questions on House File 506 from the members? Seeing none, anyone in the audience wishing to testify on House File 506? Seeing none, all those in favor of re-referring House File 506 to State Government Finance, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion is adopted. You're on your way to State Government Finance. Thank you, Representative Schoen.
Where are you going?
Give one more.
No, that one was removed. Representative Zerwas, I think we're down to... We'll take up 210 first, if that's okay with you.
Work for me, Madam Chair.
Representative Zerwas, I believe there is at least one amendment, maybe two, to this one. Is that right?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'll move House File 210 sets before the committee to be re-referred. House File 210 sets before the committee to be re-referred. I believe the General Register.
That's correct. And we have an A1, A2, and A3?
I think there's A1 and A3.
I have an A1, A2, and A3.
I have that as well, Madam Chair.
All right. Very good. Any discussion on how the A1 amendment?
I have the A1, Madam Chair. Do we have copies of the A2 and the A3?
Oh, you don't have copies of the 2 and the 3? Okay.
Perfect. All right. Let's start with the A1, Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Zerwas.
All right, I'll move the A1. Madam Chair, members, the A1 came up in... discussions in health reform. There's questions about whether a person was being sent home. Would also be if they were sent to a temporary residence, such as the home of a family member or the designated caregiver.
Okay, very fine. Any discussion on the A1? Seeing none, all of those in favor of the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The A1 is adopted, Representative Zerwas. To the A2.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The A2 amendment is designated to limit the information being released to just what's in the discharge plan, Madam Chair.
Right. Thank you. Any discussion to the A2? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A2 is adopted. To the A3, Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair and members, this is just clearing up the release language, the A3.
Thank you. Any questions or concerns on the A3 from members? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A3, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The A3 is adopted. To your bill, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I want first thank Representative Scott and Mr. Gehring from Research for helping me clear up some concerns this afternoon. This bill is designed to assist individuals as they're being discharged from the hospital and make sure that as they're leaving, they're getting the proper care coordination and a designated caregiver. If the patient chooses, the program is voluntary, can be identified, and at that point, the limited information that deals with the discharge plan and aftercare instructions can be released to that identified caregiver to help the transition. The most important part, Madam Chair and members, in this bill, as I see it, as we look at every way possible to limit hospital readmission incidents, is that it provides the detailed care and a way to contact the care provider in the pursuing few days after discharge if there are questions that arise within the care directives or care instructions. With that, Madam Chair, we have testifiers that are here and available to answer questions if there are any.
Members, are there any questions to House File 210? Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on House File 210? Ms. Krinke, please come forward. If you could introduce yourself to the tape,
yes.
Please.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. And I regret to say that the Hospital Association had not seen Amendment Number 2 or Amendment Number 3. We had signed off on Amendment Number 1. I'm not really in a position tonight to say that necessarily reduces our willingness to not be opposed to this bill. I need to run this past some folks at our shop and our attorneys who had carefully reviewed all the language in this bill. I know the issue of medical records is very sensitive with this committee. We, however, had taken the position that in order for someone who was designated to be your caregiver, and that is what this bill is about, this is about the hospital offering the opportunity. It's not a mandate, it's voluntary. This is about the hospital offering an opportunity for someone to be selected as the designated caregiver. And then there's a mandate for the hospitals to have to train that individual. So we were taking on the burden of doing that training, but there was an understanding on our part that that person would have access then to their medical record. Because how can you really be trained to care for someone if you don't have access to their medical record? So I know that that's a controversial topic within this committee, but this language does not necessarily then help the hospital if it's a two-part sign-off with both the medical record and it's no longer going to have deemed status that they do have access to the medical record. So I need some of our attorneys back at our shop to look at this, so I just want to go on the record that we had not pre-approved these amendments. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Krinke. And I would just say this was language that we talked about this afternoon, and I apologize that it didn't get around in this short period of time. Our concern was that, you know, a caregiver was going to have access to every health record out there. And just drawing from practical experience, you know, bringing my loved one home from the hospital myself, that I was just given instructions on these are the medications they need, give them at this time, this is how you take care of dressing a wound or whatever, an incision. And in no time did I feel like I needed to see this person's entire medical record. But that's where we're coming from. And Representative Zerwas, I don't know what you want to do at this point. I know that this is
Madam
going
Chair
to
General Register. If we move this bill forward at this point, I know that there's no rush to have this on the floor and available. And clearly, if there are concerns that that crop up over the Easter holiday, the Passover holiday, we will certainly, I'm not going to bring something to the floor to pass that the Minnesota Hospital Association isn't comfortable with.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
And I give you my word on that. Thank you.
Very good.
Give the committee.
Everybody's all smiles.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Krinke. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving, re-referring House File 210 to the General Register as amended, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. House File 210 is on its way to the General Register. Representative Zerwas, House File 1155.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I will move House File 1155 so it's in front of the committee.
And I believe there is just one amendment. That's the A2 amendment. And I would like to have...
No. I have an A1 and an A2, Madam Chair.
Oh, my apologies.
Madam Chair.
Oh, an A1's been incorporated already. That's right.
I don't have 1155 on my agenda, I think, do I?
Oh.
What was that?
It was on this morning, taken out and made this afternoon.
There it is.
Do you have a copy?
Yeah, I got a copy. It's in my back.
Well, we're going to show and have some.
I
wouldn't
tell them. You online?
Oh, so this is the one I asked about earlier. Is that right, Madam Chair?
The A1's been incorporated already. But it's just the A2, Madam Chair.
After meeting with Representative Zerwas this afternoon and with staff, and thank you, Mr. Gehring, for meeting with us, we did tighten up some language on this to make this a little more palatable and I think understandable too. So Mr. Gehring, would you want to go over the A2, please?
So Madam Chair, members, the A2 amendment does basically three different policy concepts. Lines 1.2 to 1.7 is adding language in three different places in the bill that clarifies that a patient has to have provided consent on an annual basis consistent with what's currently in the Health Records Act related to disclosure of medical records. Right now, the way the bill is drafted, it just provides that data may be shared to the extent necessary to coordinate services, provided that the record may be disclosed as provided under Chapter 144. And so this is adding an additional reference to the specific consent provisions in the Health Records Act to ensure that the consent requirements still apply. Line 1.8 and 1.9 requires that there be a written documentation when data in the welfare system is being shared for purposes of an individual's need to have coordinated services. Currently in the bill, the sharing is authorized to the extent necessary to coordinate services, and so what's happening here is the amendment would require written documentation of that necessity. And then finally, starting on line 1.10 of the amendment through the end, is adding some of the language we've discussed earlier. This is the MNsure-related sort of data audit trail language. This is being added to two sections of the bill that relate to access to data according to procedures that are established by relevant county boards.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ross.
At first, I want to thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank Mr. Gehring for the assistance. I really appreciate that. The lines 1.2 through 1.9 for the committee's benefit is clarifying what I believed and some believe was already being stated in the original bill, but then flat out saying to spell out annual consent. The reference back to the statute add an annual consent provision, but then listed out some exceptions. We wanted to make sure that it was very clear that annual consent, that's the way had been helped plans on operating their system. So that's that part of it is not a concern. I will say, just so we're all clear, in speaking with some of the stakeholders on line 1.16 in the amendment, The audit trail, one of the reasons we need to coordinate, and one of the reasons Hennepin County's here looking for this assistance is they're working with individuals in multiple disparate systems. And so group residential housing, homeless shelters, emergency rooms, clinics, other areas, HCMC. And so I know this is language, that's sampling language that's being used in, I think, the Minsure bills and the LPR bills, where you have one computer system to log in and do your thing. This is much more of a social worker contacting a coordinator at a group residential housing location, trying to figure out from a primary care provider within the system and coordinating care that way. So there is a little bit of concern around how do you document that and what. There isn't a central clearinghouse in this situation. Is it documented at the group residential housing? Does Dorothy Day make a note of it? And so I think we understand what the language is intended to do to make sure that the people that are accessing the information are doing it appropriately and for a very specific job function and role. But the how to actually do that in real life and document it without a central clearinghouse, like you in DVS or in a license plate reader database or in a Minsure record through the county, it just I think there is a place and a way to make a note of it. If you look up someone's information in driver vehicle services, you would attach, if you're a law enforcement agency, you would attach an ICR number to it and why you looked it up. This is just a little bit, you know, in your case, in your county's case management system. So this is just a little bit different. And so at this point, I think the county wants a little bit of time to review this and see if there's a better way to get at this, Madam Chair. And so there may be another amendment in our future to have this be a workable solution. The last thing I want to do is pass something for these folks that makes doing their job more difficult. I don't want to hamstring anyone to a further degree.
Thank you, Representative Worcester-Watts. Representative Hellstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also am very concerned. A lot of this deals with mental health data, and every year you may not have someone who is competent to consent. And they may have consented at the beginning, and then now every year they're not capable. And so you may be placing them in a situation where when someone is attempting to get mental health services that they actually making access to their records to actually treat them becomes so problematic because they're not capable of consenting.
And Representative Hellstrom, in the original bill, in the actual statute, the reference to the statute that was already in the bill, not new language, statute does say that consent will be given every year, will be given annually. That's already in current statute. In fact, that's what the reference is here. So that wasn't anything. This was more belt and suspenders, what we were doing here, versus what was in the original language that was brought to us that wasn't even brand new language.
So my question then is, why then in line or on the A2 amendment does it have if the patient has provided annual consent in every line?
Madam Chair and members, the folks from Hennepin County were comfortable with the citation back to statute. House Research thought it was clear with the reference to statute. There was some that had concerns and expressed concerns that there may be a way to make it absolutely crystal clear. And so in addition to keeping the reference back to statute, I also felt comfortable putting in the language. That portion of it, in my consultation with Hennepin County, they plan on doing an annual consent as a part of this process. So that wasn't if it made some people feel better, I wasn't gonna flip the switch and blow this thing up over that. Because Hennepin County expressed to me that they had no concerns with those provisions.
And Representative Hillstrom, there are exceptions in statute for getting that consent. It looks like Mr. Gehring is studying that. Is there anything in there that would, especially for mental health patients, that would...
And Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this only applies to Hennepin County? It applies to no one else?
Representative Zerwas, this is not just for Hennepin County, am I right?
Correct. So, Madam Chair, so he's applying Hennepin County standard to every single county in the state, and I just want to make it clear that...
Madam Chair, members, to be clear, we're applying state statute, which was cited in the original bill.
Right.
And I consulted with Hennepin County and said, because they're the ones that brought this language to me, and in talking with Hennepin County, I said, your understanding with this original bill language is that annual consent is required. They said, yes. I said, are you planning on getting annual consent every year? They said, yes. I said, if I put the words annual consent in the bill next to the citation for the statute that says you need annual consent, does that make you upset, or are you okay with that? And they said, we're okay with that.
So is everybody else other than just Hennepin County okay with that?
Madam Chair and members, the original bill refers to a statute that requires annual consent.
Mr. Geary.
Madam Chair and members, there is current law that governs access to mental health data and access to general health records, and I think the procedure for providing consent under the general provision would be that there is a process if an individual patient is incapacitated in some way for either their agent or some designated person to provide consent to release. So I think that the current process would still apply with or without this bill. So it's not the case that an individual wouldn't be able to consent, or there wouldn't be a process for getting consent for an individual's records if the bill is passed. I think the current law would cover that process.
Madam Chair.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I review that law, it looks like there are a number of circumstances where consent would not be required to be annual. There's some circumstances where consent does not expire under certain circumstances, other circumstances where there's exceptions and things. This is all contained in the statute that's referenced, 144.293. So I guess my suggestion would be rather than including the word annual, because the fact is that 144.293, the subdivisions referenced, often require annual consent but don't always. I guess my thought would be I'd be concerned that to imply that annual consent is being required under this bill where, in fact, under current law, there's some circumstances where it's not. So I'd simply suggest deleting the word annual if the author would accept that as a friendly amendment.
Well, and Madam Chair and members, we're comfortable with keeping annual in the statute. The exceptions are pretty rare. It's in case of emergency, and I think Mr. Gehring could go into a few of the other exceptions, but that's not what we're trying to get at here. We want to be able to move forward, and it's been strongly suggested that we keep it at annual.
Madam Chair, I was just going to point out, Representative Zervas, I guess as I look at the statute, it does go beyond emergency situations. I think there's quite a few. So my concern is just this would require annual consent. We should be clear. This would require annual consent under a number of circumstances where it would not be required under current law. So I think that is a difference under this. And we could walk through them, but I mean there's quite a few that are listed in 144.293. Thank you.
Representative Lash. Thank you,
Madam Chair. Yeah, I think this is kind of a big deal of what we're doing, especially in light of the Grünhagen Amendment that we passed earlier today governing the sharing of mental health data. It's a sensitive and difficult topic for a lot of people, and I don't think it should be any less sensitive and precious of information because you're poor. And I can't help but feel like that's what we're doing here, that if you have public assistance, somehow your mental health data is less of an issue and a lot more likely to be shared with other folks. Which inevitably, as we know, on the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee, sharing does make it less secure. So I am personally uncomfortable with this bill. I don't think the committee has considered it enough. I think it absolutely needs new work, more work. I know Hennepin County wants to do this because it'll make bureaucrats' jobs easier, and a lot of times those bureaucrats are doing good things, no question about that. They're helping people. But I'm concerned that this is the tail wagging the dog. So let me ask this question, if I can, Madam Chair, Representative Zerwas. You know, normally, Representative Zerwas, when folks come forward and propose a bill like this, we'll hear stories about why it's really important, you know. Here's an example of a person who we couldn't get to, and these are all the terrible ailments they suffered because we couldn't get them on their meds or something. And I have not heard any of that at all. So, I mean, maybe we could start there, because honestly, I'm not even close to being convinced on this, and normally we'd start with those kinds of stories.
Let's do back up, Representative Zerwas. I believe your testifier has plenty of those stories that she could tell us. Go ahead and state your name for the record and share your testimony, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Linda Higgins. I'm a Hennepin County Commissioner. So Hennepin Health is our safety net accountable care organization, and it was established in 2012 to provide Medicaid services for single adults without dependent children. And because Hennepin Health receives a fixed per member per month payment, just wait till you get bifocals. No matter what you do, it's not right. It can provide services that will improve our members' health that are outside the traditional health care role. And one of the keys to bringing down health care costs for our lowest income clients is that coordination of health care and social services. Since its launch in 2012, the rate of emergency department visits per thousand have decreased about 17.5% each year. The rate of inpatient admissions per thousand has decreased about 16.5% from year to year. And much of this success is due to the work that we can do to coordinate health and social services benefits. But we're constantly running into those situations that remind me of the phrase, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. But in this case, it's the left hand and the right hand aren't allowed to talk to each other. And that's to the detriment not of the bureaucrats, but of our clients. For example, two of the services Hennepin Health provides are housing navigation and employment services. So let me tell you a couple of examples on how this would work. We have a client named Dick, and he's homeless. And he carries all of his possessions around in a backpack. It weighs about 50 pounds. He goes to the doctor because he's having chest pains. Dick has Hennepin Health coverage, so the doctor calls a housing navigator and says, Dick needs to find, you need to help Dick find a place to live. He can't carry around 50 pounds on his back all day and be healthy because his heart is having real problems. He needs a place to live. He needs a place to put all of his stuff so he can move around freely and without damage to his heart. So the housing navigator is successful in finding Dick a place to live without a whole lot of time goes by. But now nobody can find Dick. He's moved into a shelter. And the shelter system is not allowed to give client information to either the doctor or to the care provider or the care coordinator who has found him housing. So there and again, the left hand and the right hand are failing Dick because they can't talk to each other. So it's 30 more days before Hennepin Health staffers can locate Dick. They tell him that they have found him a place to live. He breaks down in tears. He says he didn't think anybody cared enough about him to help, not even his doctor. We're thankful that during those 30 days, it took to find Dick that he didn't have to be hospitalized for heart problems or any of the other stress that he's enduring. Another client, Mary, has been admitted to HCMC for mental health care. Hennepin County is also working on commitment proceedings for her mental health issues. HCMC doesn't know about the possible commitment and discharges Mary from the hospital. Mary's condition deteriorates rapidly after she's discharged, so pretty soon she's readmitted. Sharing of the data from the county to the hospital might have prevented this second hospitalization. So as you can see, restrictions on data sharing limits the provider's ability to coordinate services for our clients. Without the proper interventions, they get little preventive care, are frequent users of the emergency room, and are often in poor health. Almost half have some level of chemical dependency. A lot of them, maybe a third, don't have a place, a stable place to live. More than 40% have mental health needs. 30% have more than one chronic disease. Diabetes and heart disease are the most common. And when we can work with our clients, those multiple needs are addressed by multiple service systems. Some clients may have as many as 5 different caseworkers. So this legislation will allow those care coordinators to share the information for the purposes of locating a client and providing those needed services. A client will be able to sign consent at the first face-to-face meeting and then thereafter every year. And we think this is a really important piece of the accountable care organization work that we do, and we would like your support on this. It's really important on behalf of our clients. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Higgins. Representative Lesh?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I heard those two stories, and thank you for those, Commissioner Higgins, on Dick and Sherry. Sherry? Mary. Dick and Mary. Okay.
Dick and Mary.
C-Spot Run? Wasn't that the C-Spot Run book? Okay. Thanks.
Sometimes you have to go back to basics.
The next.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
The next story would be about Spot.
Actually.
Oh, is it? Oh, yeah. Okay. Thank you. Sorry. Well, in all fairness, that book was before my time, okay? I didn't have to read Dick and Jane C-Spot Run. Just heard about it. So I'm trying to get a sense, because what this law change does is it doesn't just open up the opportunity for you to do that for Dick and Mary. It does it for everybody, right? I mean, you can do it now for everyone. What is in the proposed law change? What's the threshold that has to be met in order for you to, you know, share this information?
Representative
Zerwas. Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, and members, Representative Lesh, I think the important thing here was within the accountable care organization that Hennepin is running, what this would do is for some very high-intensity patient groups, it would allow those individuals, they would offer and say, can we coordinate your care? Can we put your whole team on the same page? And if the patient says yes, the patient will sign a waiver and a release and says, yes, please talk amongst each other, and I want a whole team effort to help me out, to get me out of long-term homelessness, to get my diabetes under control, to get my mental health coordinated, get everyone on the same team, and yes, I'll sign. And 12 months later, they're going to say, do you still like it? Do you still want to do it? Do you still want us working together? And the patient will say yes or no, and at any time in between, if the patient says, you know what, this isn't doing anything for me, and I think you're talking about me behind my back, and I don't want you to do it anymore. I want you to stop. I'm going to rescind my approval. The patient can do that. And if the patient says, is offered this service, and the patient says, no, I want to come in here when I need to come in here, and other than that, I want you to leave me the hell alone, then Hennepin County will say, okay. And they won't have you sign the form, and you'll be left alone.
How frequently, Commissioner Higgins, would you say that you interact, or the healthcare providers interact with folks like Dick and Mary?
Commissioner Higgins.
May I have a lifeline?
Sure.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. World Air Consulting. Representative Zerwas, we find ourselves in a very difficult situation here because I don't like your proposal because you're requiring annual consent, and Representative Lesch doesn't like your proposal because you're giving people too much data. So we've kind of got a problem here because both the privacy person and the not privacy, who would he would describe as the not privacy person, have difficulty with your proposal. So, Representative Zerwas, I mean, I'm happy to work with you on this proposal, but I really want to make sure that at the end of the day, we are actually making it better and not making it worse. So I pledge to work with you, but I am very troubled by where we are.
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair and members, I'm trying to balance what I think will be required to pass out of the state legislature and be signed into law and be helpful. What I've said to my friends with Hennepin County, the entire process, is at any point we get to a time when we think we're going to hinder your efforts rather than help your efforts, let me know. I got no problems. I got 48 other bills to work on. So I got no problems putting one down and picking up something else if we get to a point where this just is not going to be helpful. The annual consent was in this all along. Hennepin was fine with the annual consent all along. They are concerned about the audit trail piece just because there isn't a central clearinghouse. And I think that's something worth talking about. But the annual consent is something that they absolutely have no concern with.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Whoever can answer this. So what's the process right now for Dick and Jane to do this?
Dick and Mary.
Richard and Marilyn, how would they go about doing this right now if they came to you and said, hey, you know what, I'm single, I'm homeless, I don't want to die alone, I want somebody to know what's going on in my life, I do care about myself, but I'm on hard times.
Ms. Higgins.
The process that you're describing, how would they go about that right now?
They would, Madam Chair and Representative Schoen, if they go to the physician for health care, they would get the health care. What we're having trouble with and what this bill is supposed to do is to help get health care and welfare to talk to each other so that they have so it is coordinated. What we have trouble with now is the medicine isn't just medicine anymore. Medicine is also
I'm sorry, I didn't do a very good job at teeing that up. But I assume the answer is you can't.
I think that's the short answer that
yeah.
I probably wasn't
and
trying to say.
So there's yes. people that would benefit from this because their lives would be better,
mm-hmm.
And they need the help. And would you force them to do this?
Oh, Madam Chair, Representative Schoen, we wouldn't force people to do this. As Representative Zerwas says, somebody says, butt out of my business, then they've made their wishes pretty clear.
Well, Madam Chair, if
Representative Schoen.
Representative Lesch hates it and Representative Hilstrom hates it, that should leave about 60% of us in the middle. go do this. Right? I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there. No, I mean, it just seems like there's some reasonable accommodations. The bottom line is I think I'm leaning more towards Representative Hilstrom on the idea that I don't know, maybe the year thing, I don't necessarily understand the objection to that, but I understand Representative Lesch's objection. No, I don't understand it, but I know that it's there. And because they're not being forced to do it, these folks really, I mean, these are folks that they want the help. That's my understanding. They're just trying to get the care coordination. Reality is like, hey, we need to find somebody to help this person find housing or some place to stay because hoisting around a 50-pound backpack when you're 65, 70 years old and homeless or whatever that is, or have some sort of heart condition, if they go into heart failure and you're doing that, I mean, you just can't do it. and that goes down a block. I mean, Representative Zerwask, I mean, can't even use the stairs because of his conditions. No, that's a real deal. I mean, but point being, there's a lot more people like you in the world that don't have the resources, a bed to lay in, and a family support system. And I think that's really what we're trying to put in place when the shit's not there. So, I mean, I'm supportive of where it's at if there's some minor tweaks, but I don't know how you get around the concerns on polar opposites when someone wants to do this. They volunteer to do this. So I think that's the important factor here to me is the voluntary part. I mean, well, and I understand if it wasn't voluntary, I'd probably be a little bit sideways about it.
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair's members, and that's one of the, that's kind of been the dance, is how do you thread the needle so that practitioners and social service groups and you, people can talk to each other enough to take care of the patient and to take care of the client and do what's right and do what's best and yet limit it enough so it's not abused. What I will say is we see in a population within this subset a very expensive, a very small group, but a very expensive group to care for. And I don't know how many times I've heard, certainly my party, say, we need government to work smarter, not harder. We need business to work smarter, not harder. And we need to be problem solvers. We need to work together. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to put in under very strict controls, in this case, annual controls, a system that allows care coordination to allow social service workers, counselors, mental health professionals, housing professionals, workforce employment professionals, to all come together and say, here's Dick or Jane or
Mary
or whoever, Sally, or, here's our person, here's all the things they're up against. How do we best take care of that person? We hear time and time again about people, especially poor people, getting lost in the shuffle and falling through the cracks. Let's help Edmond County fill in some of the seams. For the few people that want to participate in this, let's help them fill in the seams and let's help them get something done here.
Madam Chair.
I think Representative Pinto was first.
Well, actually, okay. We were still on
my
lifeline,
madam.
Okay.
All right.
She was getting, and Representative Hillstrom used the break to. So I would like Commissioner Agus to be able to use her lifeline.
Yep, if you want
to. Former Senator Berglund, welcome to the committee. Please present or tell us your name and present your testimony.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm a public policy program manager for Hennepin County, and I work with the Hennepin Health Program. So in the example, these were real examples. Dick had signed consent at the hospital with his doctor so his doctor could call and tell a housing navigator that he had a condition that needed assistance with housing. But the law prevents the housing navigator on the county side to call the doctor back and say, we got Dick housing. This bill would allow that to happen.
Okay, but my question was, how frequently? My question relates to the annual consent piece. How frequently are they seeing health care providers that are going to need to partake of a consent form like this?
Senator Berglund.
Today, the data privacy laws require everyone to sign a consent annually to have any of their medical records or any medical information released. So if they don't see a doctor annually, then when they did see the doctor the next time, that chart would be flagged to have that form signed.
And I think Senator Berglund, his question was more how frequent is this happening? How many patients are we talking about?
We have at least a top 200 all the time, top 200 utilizers that we are trying to coordinate services for, and these are usually people whose lives are in the most disarray, and that's why we need to be able to share data to be able to find them and coordinate services.
Representative okay. Zerwas has a brief comment.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just I think what we're trying to get at is, to former Senator Berglund, these top 200, are they coming in every 5 months? Are they coming in every 3 months? How often are we interacting with those top?
Well, those top 200 are being seen every week by some part of the system, and sometimes 3, 4, 5, 10 times a week.
Representative Lesch.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And this is the reason for my question, because you've almost convinced me, okay? Now, I think what is being missing from this discussion is, you know, mental health diagnoses are still very much a stigma for a lot of people. And I understand we're dealing with a different economic population, okay? And some may think, well, it's not as much of a stigma if you're homeless. Well, okay, maybe. At the same time, I want to afford these folks the same rights and opportunities to their privacy in light of that social stigma as anyone else does. The argument is that, yeah, but they're never going to get out of this rut if we can't help them out, if we don't have the tools to help them out and get that. I remember the first time as prosecutor, I don't know, it might have been years ago it was, there's a guy that kept breaking into houses, and he had chemical abuse problems, he had mental health problems, but he had fundamentally a theft problem too, which could have been related to those other two, but not necessarily, okay? And the judge was saying from the bench, and he was a recurring, we call him frequent flyers, he was a frequent flyer in front of the bench, and the judge said to him, what's it going to take for us to get you back on track? And I remember the guy saying, shaking his head, he's like, I don't know, Your Honor, I think I just probably need a good caseworker. I chuckled at it because I hadn't heard someone admit, you know, on the record essentially that they were kind of lost cause. They needed someone to help them out and coordinate this stuff as they couldn't make it happen. So I do get that side of it. I absolutely do get it. I've seen it occasionally, but not frequently. So no more questions, Manager. I think they probably have convinced me. I'm not going to – and I appreciate the work you've done and put in on this, but I still think that our sensitivity over individual Minnesotans and the stigma related to their mental health data is a significant issue.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lesch. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to say that a mental health record is considered a health record and would have to have annual consent to share that record or any part of that record. So. But if it's going to be shared, it would be allowed under this bill to be shared with a housing navigator, perhaps, because a person needs housing.
And
Representative Zerwas.
And Madam Chair, we see this more in the Health and Human Service Policy or Reform Committee, and so I apologize going into this level of detail, but a lot of times what that group residential housing or supportive housing will be, which will allow, from a provider point of view, is to place someone in to a group residential housing setting or a housing setting specifically designed for people with mental health issues. And we'll have the resources there to assist that individual. And so I think it is important. It's a consent-based approach. And I, you know, my big thing moving forward is for Representative Hillstrom. I know I'm open to working with any and all comers. I see what Hennepin County is struggling with, where they have their top 200 list, and it could probably be brought down to a top 500 or a top 1,000 list. And it's such, I don't know if you were at the Ways and Means Chair's presentation on the state's budget a few weeks back, and what MA does in the out years, in the MA expenses that this state will be facing, It's going to absolutely explode. And either we decide that we're going to take a policy perspective of we need to do whatever we can do while respecting people's rights, while respecting people's privacy, but if we have a group of that needs extra help and they're asking for it and they're willing to give their permission for it, if we can either help them and save money or cast them aside and let them navigate it on their own and just keep throwing dollars their way. At some point, we got to do something. This approach has already saved Hennepin County money. We heard about the decrease in their readmission. But closing this loop and allowing the connection of the social service, that's a huge component of this. It's vitally important. If we have to tighten it up more, I'll tighten it up more. But I just think it's critically important. And if we don't address this issue in the next few years, that MA explosion is going to be so big, and that number is going to be so crushing, I don't know how the state of Minnesota is really going to address it.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. I want to get to the rest of the questions. Representative Pinto, Hillstrom, and Johnson.
Yeah, I'll just say thank you to the representative, the commissioner, and the senator. I think this is great. And if it's won over Representative Lesh, I don't want to say anything more because I don't want to jinx it. So I'll stop.
Thank God.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I think that what you're trying to do here is the right thing. I just want to make sure that the annual consent and the restrictions that we put on it don't end up making it worse for people who can't really consent.
Senator Berglund, did you have a comment to that point?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to say that we will check with our attorneys also to make sure that it won't be misinterpreted that the exceptions to the annual consent are still applicable here.
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Zerwas, I want to thank you. I think this program could actually save the tax dollars of Hennepin County and all the tax dollars, all the people in Minnesota, some tax dollars, and also help the people that need the help. But one thing I would do is would suggest that if there's counties going to participate in a program like this, that they have some very strict policies and procedures drawn up first, dealing with this data sharing, and if there's any violations, strict consequences are enacted immediately.
Thank you, Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair and members, within the legislation, there's an entire, I think, two sections devoted to counties developing those policies.
Thank you. And is there somewhere in this that actually, this bill that actually says it's only Hennepin County that this applies to? Representative or Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, no, this would be a statewide bill, and we have a letter of support from Essentia and St. Louis County that are very anxious to have this school. We have a letter from the Association of Counties statewide.
And I would look forward to hearing back from you in about a year after enactment here to see how it's going and see if we're making progress.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh.
You know, I'd point out again that there's a letter in support of Senate File 1078 here. I don't see anything in support of House File 1155. So just a little demonstration for who's ever writing.
Senate please files. Refer to the House File.
We are still the House of Representatives.
Yes.
An honor to be here.
The chief proponents notwithstanding.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh, or I mean Zerwas.
I've never given such a compliment. I wish I dressed that nice. Madam Chair and members, one question on the A2. We don't have that central clearinghouse like we would with a DVS or a MNsure or an LPR database, Madam Chair. And I'm wondering on 1.15, after the period following purpose, if we could scratch the audit trail provision, Madam Chair, down to 1.18 in the period after law, just because I don't, quite practically, Madam Chair and members, I don't know how they could comply with that.
Representative Zerwas, back in the olden days, we used a piece of paper and a pen. And
yeah, we don't have a problem putting it in the record of the client. It's just that if somebody came and said, now we want you to give us a list of all the clients that have this in their record, you know, we wouldn't be able to call the shelter up and say, how many times did you do this and who did you do this for, because they wouldn't be able to pull it out of their files.
Representative Zerwas, that's a section I'd like to work with you post this committee, because
that's understandable, Madam Chair.
If we're going to make other entities live by this, then,
yep.
No. It's a huge privilege right here.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I understand where you're going with this. We're not dealing with a central database. I think that's the problem. If we had a central database coordinating all this, it just, for the benefit of the members, the deletion that I proposed would still leave in the very strong language of talking about an individual that basically uses this information for any other reason would be the subject of the prosecution and be mandated to be forwarded to the county attorney. We don't have any problems with leaving that in, trust me, Madam Chair. It's just like this idea of doing an audit trail, since there is no central location. The concern is they don't know where they're going to store it.
Right, I understand.
But that's something we can talk about
right.
after we get the heck out of this committee, Madam.
Right, but understanding that no one's going to know whether these people are not are accessing it legally or according to according to the rules or not, if there's no sort of way to check that. So that's my hang-up. So with that, members, we need to adopt the A2. Is there any further discussion on the A2? I think we've beat it to death here. All those in favor of adopting the A2, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. The A2 is adopted. Is there further discussion on this bill? Anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill?
Did we adopt the
A1? We did. Correct? We adopted the A1, right?
Yeah. A1's engrossed.
Yeah. All those in favor of moving House File 1155 to the General Register, please signify as amended. Please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. House File 1155 is on its way to the General Register with a few stops in between.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I just... First off, my apologies for keeping us late right before break, but also my sincere thank you all for continuing to work with me on this. I think it's a worthy bill, and I think it's a worthy cause, and I understand there's a little bit more work to do. For that, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. With that, folks, we are through our list of bills, and this is most likely our last committee meeting unless we have some informational ones, which I've talked to a few of you about. I would like to thank our pages. We've got Micah, and Mike is usually here. The gentleman with us tonight is
Simon.
And I would like to thank those folks for being great pages for our committee. I'd like to thank DFL staff, Dave, and I'd like to thank my staff, Kelly, Lauren and Alex, and I'd like to thank House staff as well. Couldn't have done it without you, and thanks everybody for your participation in the Civil Law Data Practices Committee for this year.
Madam Chair, if I may, I'm speaking on behalf of the DFL, the Minority Committee. Normally, I really like us to fight a lot more and be a little bit nastier. It's more interesting. And we have a ratings game to keep up here as well. But you and your staff have been incredibly easy to work with in getting the job done in here. And so we've had our fights, as we should, in this committee. But I appreciate you running it in such a civil way and having conversations with me offline to fix things that need to be fixed as well. And I appreciated all of the majority's input. And I think I speak on behalf of all the DFL members in saying that. So thank you.
Thank you. And I did leave out the minority lead, and it's been a pleasure to work with you as well. So with that, folks, we are adjourned. Go home.